This is Dr. Richard Verone continuing my oral history interview for the B&M Archives Oral History Project with Mr. Joseph J. Welsh. Today is May 31st, 2005, and it's 2:15 p.m. Central Standard Time. Joey, you're in Castroville, and I'm in Lubbock. This is where we left off, Joey. You were basically getting ready to ship out and go over to the Republic of Vietnam. Can you tell me a little bit about your arrival in country? Did you go over by civilian air, or did you go with military air?
No, I went by, since I was an individual volunteer and left Germany and went what they called on an individual basis, mm-hmm. They had contracts civilian air. So we went with civilian air and...
Do you remember the flight, what it was like?
I guess you could call it kind of, quiet. I was excited. And then when you, right before they get there, they tell you, you're getting ready to approach. We're going to be doing a little bit steeper approach than normal and stuff like that, But once you've been through that once and the second time back, you realize it ain't no steeper than nothing else. It's just, I think it's just to fire the people up or whatever. And when you land, we landed in Cameron Bay, and it was, blast of heat.
Mm-hmm.
And I went over in February, and I was in Class A. Then they put you on bus, and you go to the 90th replacement. You take them off, and you put on jungle fatigue. Now, paratrooper's tradition was he keeps his jump boots, and then another paratrooper that's leaving will come up to you.
Mm-hmm.
Normally they're grunts because, they got their boots are all beat to shit.
Mm-hmm.
And they say, hey, what size you got? They introduce himself, and I found a guy, he wore my size, and I gave him my jump boots, and he gave me his jungle boots. And now I got broken in jungle boots, and he's got new jump boots. That was a tradition the whole time I was there, that you always made sure that, you found somebody to give your boots to, and then you have a broken in pair of jungle boots, to break them in.
Right.
And, nothing really happened there. It was a turtle farm, just a processing system. I did meet a hometown friend from there, and he's in station. He was an admin.
Mm-hmm.
He said, we get mortared once in a while. He said, but, no big thing.
Yeah.
And I had requested to go to 173rd Airborne, and I wound up with orders to go to 101st.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess I was there maybe 3 to 5 days, and then they put you on a plane, and then I went up north on the east coast to Phan Rang, where the air base was, where the 101st was. And from there, you go up on the hill as the replacement. And that's for the incoming and outgoing.
What do you mean, go up on the hill?
Well, we call it the hill. It's in the base camp. It's up on the hill closer to the perimeter, because that's where they run the in-country 2-week orientation course, where they put you through, regardless of what your job is, they put you through small infantry tactics, booby traps, and it also is getting you climatized.
How difficult was that for you?
I'm not difficult at all. I loved it, it was hot, but that, because, it was February when I left, but that's another reason. They want to get your body climatized, at the same time. And they show you different weapons and how to set up claymores and how to do this and booby traps, and then they break out their zoo. And they show you every critter. They bring out spitting cobras and all this kind of stuff. All the critters that you could run into and how to handle it. And in the meantime, the old timers, they're out there yelling, carrying all that, busting your butt. It's just tradition. But you spend about 2 weeks there, and then from there, once you're done that, And it's good. It's a good initial indoctrination, because not only does it get you climatized, but for people who don't have a combat arms MOS, they really do put some good stuff in their heads that, you know, they need to know.
Yeah.
Because, you know, whether you're staying in the base camp or you're going out in the field, it's really great stuff that they do. And it's the guys who are run it are all, you know, been there a year, 2 years, whatever, online. So it's real good.
What are those guys telling you about what's happening there?
They sort of give you an idea of what you're up against, what the enemy's like, what's a little bit more than you ever knew, you know, how it works, you know. They run around town during the day and shooting at you at night, and, you know, test the VC, and then the difference between VC and NVA, and then what to do on how you work perimeter guard, and what to do when you're on perimeter guard as compared to what to do if you're on a patrol. They actually take these on patrols, and you get to fire, you know, the M60 and the machine guns, the LOL, throw grenades, and then go up and throw grenades in bunkers and lay right next to it while it explodes and stuff. You know, it gets you some good realistic, to some people who had never, you know, been through that, it's really good training. You know, I had done it before, but it was still great. But you get, the pounds just start shedding. I mean, I lost, I went over there 170 and came back 135.
Wow.
You know?
Wow.
But I mean, I was hard as a rock, but I was light, you know?
Do you remember anything they told you? I mean, like specifics about the enemy and about the terrain and the critters, as you said, that you
Well, yeah, it's all mixed in with, this is, even for you guys, they'll say, even for you guys are coming out of Tiger School, which was, you know, guys coming right out of infantry training, where they have a simulated Vietnam area.
Yeah.
He said, you know, that's in Louisiana. Okay.
Yep.
This is Vietnam. And so, you know, you got to pay attention. You have got to pay attention to that private. If you're an E5, pay attention to that private. You know, that's who they're going to hook you up with. Because that private has been there 7 months. He survived. You officers, you better pay attention to your platoon sergeants. Because, you know, the average life expectancy of a second lieutenant is 90 days.
Yeah.
And that's stretching it. So you can take that book and stick it up your ass and pay attention here and listen to your platoon sergeant, and they'll get you through it. Or you can go over there, go out there and play King of the Hill, and you'll wind up going home and, you know, in a casket. I mean, they were straightforward. There was no harassment. It was just good, strict, telling you right out just how it is, you know, and how, what you can run up against, and what to look for, and how to be suspicious of workers on camp. If you'll see someone, keep an eye on them. You get to know them, they get you friendly. I mean, some of these guys, you know, they lived in air-conditioned barracks the whole time, and they had maids and stuff, you know. And he said, always be watching. You'll watch a guy if he goes out and he's pacing off. If he looks like he's pacing off something, you know, or walking the same route every day, take note of that. Report it to your S2 intel. Because what he's doing is he's marking for mortars and rocket attacks. So it was so much, you know, it was great. And then until some monkeys got loose. And they were squirrel monkeys. So, you know, all these crazy guys went and, you know, tried to catch them. Well, I wasn't that dumb. And they were climbing on the tents, and this one guy grabbed one by the tail, and six of them were on him, man.
Wow.
Chewing them up, you know. So, you know, it was real good training. You know, it was quick, hard, fast, but you was acclimatized. He was used to the weather, the water, the conditions, and stuff like that at that level.
Right.
And which was meaning that besides a few nights of patrolling, that you got some good hot chow.
Yeah.
And, you know, and then from there you were shipped to your unit. And you went down to your unit, got your equipment, and you either went forward, which I did, or you stayed there, or you went wherever your unit was, because being a brigade, only one brigade, with maybe three battalions and plus a support battalion and artillery, you know, they could be split up anywhere.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so I winded up heading up on my first convoy, and this is something I got to bring up.
Okay.
At night, we started seeing these fires along the outer perimeters.
This is at Fan Rang?
Yeah, this is at the base camp. Mm-hmm. And we asked, what's that? And he said, well, that's our outer security. That's the Rock Marines are up there. And I said, well, why the hell are they lighting the fires? He said, that's to let the VC know where they're at, so they come and get them. They never, ever attacked Fan Rang. I mean, that's how crazy Rocks were up there. I mean, they covered that whole perimeter, outer.
Mm-hmm.
We took the inner.
Mm-hmm.
But they would light bonfires, you know. Of course, they wouldn't sit there, but they would light bonfires and say, come on, Charlie.
Yeah.
You know.
Tell me your impression about the Rocks.
Oh, hard. Hard as nails. I went through Mac B. Riconde school with four of them. And one of them was the honor graduate.
Mm-hmm.
And they were in, you know, the first week is, for the Americans, you had to be in combat or in a LERP team for 6 months before you could be accepted to the school. When I went to school, I thought I was in pretty good shape. Well, after about the third day, you could hardly move. I mean, with the pain. I mean, you couldn't even laugh. Well, the Koreans would work out. We would sit down and take a break. Well, I had some martial arts experience, so I started working out with them. And I was loosening up. I was feeling good. You know, I got to know them, and a black guy I knew real well from the 25th. He had been in Korea, spoke enough Korean where, you know, us guys started hanging out. And every day, at every break, I'd work out with him. And in the evening, when we had time. And the soreness went away, you know.
Mm-hmm.
That's from the stretching and everything. And I made it through the first week, which was unbelievable. And then the second week, they take you out in the field, in a field environment, and then you put into practice what you had learned in the classroom.
Mm-hmm.
And one of them is small boat infiltration. And we'd have to take out large 15-man boats and row them out there, flip them over, flip them back over, and then row them back. And it sort of was like a two-boat race,
right.
You know, for competitors. So we were out there that one day training, and my Korean buddy, who's a little guy,
mm-hmm.
Of course he's a black belt and all that, we started messing around, so everybody got around. I said, come on, you know, nobody else would ever go near these guys. So the black guy said, you know, he wants to spar with you. I said, well, yeah, I said, you know, what are we going to do here? Is it going to be heavy, light, or what? And he said, no, he said, you know, he'll go at your pace, you know. So we started kicking the shit out of each other and throwing each other around. I mean, we must have fought for 15 minutes, man. I'll tell you what. You know, it was fun, you know. It got into it, and, you know, if he got dirty, I got dirtier, you know. And
yeah.
He, you know, I mean, if it was a real situation, I would have tried to kill him, and he would have tried to kill me.
Right.
But he knew that, I guess, that I had it in me to take so much and what I could do, and so he just made me bring it out, and shit, we got a standing ovation and screaming, yelling, and everybody, you know, he's bowing to me and all that,
mm-hmm.
and the Koreans are all shaking my hands like, this American's got balls, you know?
Yeah.
I said, well, you know, after that, you know, the Americans damn sure didn't mess with me, you know, and I became super buddies with them,
mm-hmm.
and we swapped a uniform exchange, which is a tradition,
mm-hmm.
and...
What is involved in that?
Well, we give them an entire set of camouflage or tigers, in their case, because they're smaller,
mm-hmm.
and then he gave me a set of his camouflage uniform.
That's cool.
Yeah, oh yeah, it was great. And then... the guy who was the Army Korean, he was the honor graduate. I mean, he was hard on nails. He was first on every... You start off with... in SF, they do the PT different. They do their warm-up stretching and then their runs or their rough marches first. And then when they come back, then they do calisthenics till you're dead.
Mm-hmm.
This way you're already warmed up, you know? Well, the first day they take you out there a couple miles and back so you know, you get oriented. Then after that, you go out and you have got full field equipment, everything, weapon, fully ammo, everything, and you either carry a radio and rations or they put a 35-pound, whatever it is, as much as they can get in the rucksack, and they weigh it, and they put it on your back, and they open the gate, and they say, go.
Mm-hmm.
When the time is up, and you start off at 2 miles, you go 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, something like that. And when the time is closed, if they're done, they close the gate. If you're on the other side of the gate, you pack your bag. And you cannot walk it. You've got to be able to run at least half of it.
Mm-hmm.
About the third day, I come back in, and I went to school with three other guys from the unit. And one of them was missing.
Yeah.
Missing totally. And he had been over there about 7 months. Well, they found him laying on the side of the road. We found out later, and they met him back and never seen him again. Apparently, he had a heart murmur this whole time that the Army never picked up, and he had been humping the hills for 7 months, but it took a toll on him, and they medevaced him to the States. He never returned.
Mm-hmm.
Basically, he had a heart attack, and he was only like 20 years old.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow. Okay, well, getting back in country,
yeah,
you mentioned Iraq.
My first deployment was, I got my stuff, I met my platoon, and we were heading up the northwest to Guangdong, the place is called. Long convoy, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, you're nervous about everything. I'm riding shotgun, and we pull over, and it's real thick jungle and all, so everybody take a break, you know, so... we're taking a break and watching and everything like that, and we're waiting, and I said, what are we waiting for, you know, and the student sergeant said, you'll see. All of a sudden, I hear these shifting the gears, and here comes two brand new shell tankers,
mm-hmm.
shiny aluminum shell tankers, two of them come uh-huh. riding past us. One guy in there driving, one guy riding shotgun. I said, what the hell is this? I said, how do they make it? He said, they pay the NBA. I said, get out of here. He said, how else do you think they make it? So, boing, you know, wake up. So we're getting in, and as we're getting in, you know, they pull out, you know, a guy turns out. As we turn out, I'm checking the side and the rear, and I look, and I say, hey, start with me. He said, shut up. And I see a guy by himself slipping into the jungle. And he said, just shut up.
Mm-hmm.
We keep going. I said, and, you know, as we start moving, I said, what the hell is that? He said, a sniper. I said, by himself? I said, Jesus Christ, we got like 30 miles to go before the base camp.
Mm-hmm.
He said, well, the units are spread out. He said, but yeah, that's where he's going. I said, damn, man.
Wow.
I said, I'd like to be with him. He said, no, you won't. He said, you think so now? I said, but I thought that, you know, you had two men, well, this is before we did. He said, two men snipers. He said, well, they do at times, but this is a different thing.
Mm-hmm.
By himself, this guy just wandered into the jungle.
Wow.
And that was, to me, that was totally awesome.
And you, did that make you want to, hey, I want to do that someday. I want to be able to do that someday. Or something
similar.
Yeah,
oh yeah. I would have probably went then.
Yeah.
But, I didn't know enough.
Mm-hmm.
And snipers, it's hard to get into snipers in the Army. You have to be at the right time, the right place. Once you're over there and you're locked in the system, you're kind of locked.
Yeah.
Usually they'll come from the infantry battalions or the scouts, and, you know, they're hand-picked.
Yeah.
And they've got to be really, really good, you know.
Yeah.
Same way with the Marines. Nowadays, you know, we have the sniper school with Benning, and then we have the Special Forces sniper school. You know, there's a lot more of them. You know, and mm-hmm. each unit has them trained up already.
Mm-hmm.
But, and then we went up there without any incident, and, you know, I'm figuring we're going to get hit at every turn, and basically, you know, the platoon sergeant said, we've been pretty lucky. He said, occasionally something will come down, but they know who we are. And I said, who are we? He said, well, they call us the chicken soldiers with black sticks.
Hmm.
I mean, you know, the 101st, the Screaming Eagle with M16.
Mm-hmm.
He said, that's why we don't get a perimeter hit in our convoys, he said, because of our, you know, you got to realize, he said, we're riding through the countryside, but our men, our infantry, are all working all around us.
Mm-hmm.
So the enemy knows that if they attack us, then they're going to play, you know, catch hell.
Yeah.
So I don't know if he was doing that to comfort me or what, but it didn't work. I was still scared shitless.
Were you really scared?
Well, you're not scared, and your anticipation. You know, you want to do it and see what happens. You need that baptism, you know.
Yeah. Yeah,
and it didn't take long. We got there early in the evening, and we didn't have time to really, you know, build anything. So we threw some sandbags and some logs, and we had the rocks with us, the Rock Army, and they had these, like, 5-ton trucks with 30 millimeters sitting on them, okay? And they were, you know, placed around our defense. There was a few of them. And that night, I don't know, somebody shot something, and I remember seeing some tracers, and then all hell broke loose, and man, we were just shooting, and everything was in front of us.
Where were you?
I was laying behind a big log with some sandbags, and then all of a sudden, it scared the hell out of me. The truck, which was only about 30, maybe 20 yards from me, that thing opened up, man, and I just froze, man. I just looked at that thing, and that guy with that 30 cal was just wiping out the
mm-hmm.
You know, everybody else just stopped shooting.
Mm-hmm.
And a couple of them opened up for about 10 minutes, and then we stopped, and it was silence. That was it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and next day they went out there, and there was dead dogs, dead cows, anything that was out there, but they didn't find any bodies. So we don't know whatever happened, but it was pretty neat, you
yeah.
know. Except, you know, you feel so naked,
mm-hmm.
you know. Yeah, I thought I felt naked until I got really into this stuff, you know.
What do you mean, naked? Can you describe that?
Well, yeah, I mean, you know, you get this little log, and, you know, God forbid if it's a company size, you ain't got much, you know, defense, because you haven't established your perimeter yet. Once
mm-hmm.
we got there, we built bunkers, and we put up tents, and we have 9-high, 2-thick sandbags all the way around each tent. You'd have a bunker, you know, something that you could, you know, have some cover, with, you know, because concealment was impossible. You're not going to conceal a base camp like that. Well, we called it an FSC, a forward support element. That's where we would establish the base camp, and we would run the supporting systems out to the grunts, and the grunts would come back and forth. They'd go up first, clear the place, and then we'd move in, you know, and that's how they moved the troops in.
Right.
You know, and then I got with the scouts, so I got more into moving forward with them and stuff like that, dismounted and mounted, mostly mounted. And so then it became a little bit different, you know, where you got to go, you know, in there first.
Mm-hmm.
And then when you go to LERPs, then it's entirely different. I mean, then
right.
it's, you know, but when you go to LERPs, you also have to go through another couple weeks of training.
Right.
We're there, and then they take you out on patrols, and the peers decide whether you stay or go, or you
right.
can quit at any time.
Right.
If you quit, you quit. That's it. Because, you know, it's all volunteer. And after you've been on a couple missions and they feel that you're good enough, then you go to Recondo School down in, run by the 5th Special Forces Project Delta.
Mm-hmm.
And that is the best school that I have ever had in 25 years in the Army. Because it's the only school that in order to graduate, you must go on a live combat mission and come back.
Wow.
And it was nothing but total, total, professionalism,
mm-hmm.
Experience. The guys, in fact, when they did the interview on the History Channel and the whole hour was about Recondo School,
mm-hmm.
my instructor was sitting there and interviewing him. I couldn't believe it. I started yelling. My wife liked to jump out of her seat. I ran down the room. I'm grabbing this book and I pulled out a notebook that I had. And because his name is Clancy, right?
Mm-hmm.
And I said, and I was showing her, look, see, stay on Clancy, see, okay, take it easy, you know. And he's sitting there with his green beret and his little SF association.
Mm-hmm.
But they were hardcore guys. I mean, he had been over there like 38 months. And they trained you up and they kept five men and with one SF guy. And, you know, you went through the whole thing together. And then, when you went in on your mission, you know, they would pick a team leader. You would rotate around and they pick a team leader, you know, to lead the mission.
Mm-hmm.
And he was there just in case, you know, something went wrong.
Right.
And, the 101st was mostly jumping from place to place and just chasing. We were basically in the two-core zone, up and down the East Coast mostly. We went from Kwangdong up to Duk Pho. Now, I don't know if they wanted on your service ribbon,
mm-hmm.
if you make a waterborne assault or something, you know,
mm-hmm.
you get this thing for an assault. I don't know what it was, what the idea was, but they put us on, the 101st Airborne, they put us on LSTs, which are just these big, huge, gutted out boats where they put all your vehicles and all down the bottom, and then you sleep in between that and the top. The top is flat,
mm-hmm.
you know, I mean. And we spent 24 hours going up the coast, and they had already had the infantry forward element in there, supposedly, you know, keeping the area clear. And I'll never forget, you know, we dropped the thing down, and off we go, and the first one just sunk right up.
mm-hmm.
We didn't know what the hell we were doing.
Now, when was this, Joey? This was...
This is about 3 months after I was there, about 3 months. We had moved out and moved up to Duk Pho.
Mm-hmm.
And like I said, instead of flying us up there, they were going to try to do this basically beach assault.
Mm-hmm.
You know, of course, after the first truck sank all the way in.
Mm-hmm.
Then the engineers that were there, they started pulling us off and showing us how to do it. And then we just dumped everything on that beach.
Mm-hmm.
And that was the ammo point and everything. And then we moved inland and we established a big base camp,
okay.
which took weeks. But during that time, we left the ammo on the beach.
Mm-hmm.
So that was the ammo point. Which was about maybe a half a mile.
Mm-hmm.
With a little knoll that you had to go over and, you know, drive to the beach. And then they hit the beach. They didn't hit the base camp, they hit the beach.
Mm-hmm.
And that thing went up and it blew up for hours. And then I remember about, oh, it must have been 10 o'clock at night, I was walking, I was living next to the medevac. And the biggest explosion I've ever felt or seen in my life, because it lit up the whole world and knocked me at least 5 feet up in the air, threw me right down on the ground. And that was the ending of the, it had finally reached the ammo point, had finally reached the big stuff. And it just, because the guys that were up there told me they just, once they started getting hit, they just all stopped their vehicles and ran to get over that knoll.
Mm-hmm.
And they just let it blow up. There was nothing you can't do. You can't do nothing about it. And when it finally hit the big stuff, like I said, it just created this, like, I guess, the biggest explosion I've ever seen, you know, and it knocked me down.
Mm-hmm.
It knocked me down, and there wasn't another pop after that. And we went back the next day, and just about every vehicle was turned over. I mean, the whole beach was shredded.
Wow.
So what we did is, well, we had been looking for them, because what they were doing was, and they do this a lot, is you put an outer perimeter, like out on the hilltop, then you have your inner perimeter in your base camp.
Can you tell me, or tell people listening to this, how you guys were trained to set up a perimeter? What exactly would you do?
Okay, well, first of all, usually your engineers will clear a good, oh, maybe 50, 100 yards all the way around the perimeter. That's your safety zone. In that area, you can do several things. We used to bury 55-gallon drums of JP fuel and have electrical charges, and depending upon how long you're going to be there. Okay? And then you establish, at a minimum, several layers and strands of concertina wire and high, right?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And then behind that, you'll start building your bunkers. Some of them are underground and above ground, and that consists of maybe four thick, eight high sandbags, the PSP, which is what they use, it's steel interlocking long layers with holes in it to build airstrips. You lay that on top, and then you put more sandbags, and you'll leave little portholes,
mm-hmm.
you know, so that you can watch, you know, and fire out of and make it harder. And then in there, you'll build grenade sump so that if something comes in, the terrain is built so it rolls down into these holes in the corner.
Mm-hmm.
And hopefully it rolls down in the hole and goes off before, you know, it goes, you know, if mm-hmm. the grenade does come in. And that's basically what you do. And then everything is, your helicopters are all, you know, covered little square, I shouldn't say square, I should say like a U mm-hmm. where they can back into. You know, hover, mm-hmm. and so they're covered so that if anything comes in, you know, from the side or back, they've got covering from the sandbags.
Mm-hmm.
Filling sandbags was an everyday, ongoing, always, always improving your position, making it better, stronger, more defensible.
did you all hate doing that, or just knew that
it was just like burning shit. You had to burn shit every morning, too, because we cut the 55-gallon drums off that quarter way, halfway, and we built these little wood makeshift latrines, and you go in there and take a dump, and then you have these little hinged doors in the back, and you had a piece of wrought iron that you'd hook onto, and you'd pull it out, and you'd put this mixture of fuel and diesel in there, and you'd burn shit every morning.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it was just part of the tour. Mm-hmm. You know,
yeah,
you didn't like doing the sandbags, but when the shit hit the fan, you was damn sure glad you had them, because if something come down, what you do is roll off your bunk, get your stuff, and you could low crawl
mm-hmm.
and right out into a bunker. If you're smart, you know,
mm-hmm.
If you happen to be sleeping or something like that,
mm-hmm.
you know, so unless you get a direct hit, you know, you got a pretty good chance. And then I've been in base camps, bigger base camps, where, you know, in the major base camps, they'll build double towers. So there's one on the bottom and one on top. Okay, mm-hmm. and these things might be 20 foot in the air.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, they're the ones for the big base camps. However, if they happen to hit one of them, which one of my best friends was, everything goes up that's in there. All your grenades, your machine gun, all your ammo, everything explodes. And he got hit on one of them double towers. He was the only guy that survived. They found him 120 foot away with no legs and half arm missing. But because he was on a base camp and he was only 5 minutes, not even 5 minutes for a chopper ride, that's how he survived.
Mm.
They never even found the other three guys.
Okay.
I mean, it was just pieces, you know. But that's what you do, and you work out of there for weeks or months, and then you move to another place and jump top. You know, mm-hmm. you jump to tactical operations center. In the meantime, the cab is out there in the outer perimeter working, and then you have your infantry battalion spread out even deeper.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, and then you have your forward support artillery bases that are out even further, halfway between you and the troops, so that they can reach out and touch somebody,
mm-hmm.
and your combo guys. So there's a staging areas, you know. I would say it takes, on average, five to seven men to equip one infantryman. I mean, from the time it comes off the ship or plane and it gets to the man in the field, his beans, his bullets, you know, mm-hmm. as we say, you know, beans, bullets, ammo, beans, bullets, I mean, beans, bullets, and stuff like that, it takes, and we always called them ramps, rear echelon motherfuckers, excuse mm-hmm. the language, but without them, you learn later, and as you become more experienced, without them, you can't survive. You can't survive because, you know, they're the ones that are humping this stuff. And I've been there with them driving shotgun when them guys would be unloading ammo at night.
Mm-hmm.
And boy, I mean, they come flying in there with them forklifts and, you know, 155 rounds. And they shoom at night, you know, and they pick it up and throw it on the back of the truck. And I said, Jesus God, I'd rather be out of the field, you know, one of these grow. But they were some hard working son of a guns, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And they really, until you get, when I came back in the Army, I made sure that every one of my men knew and understood how the system worked. And that they're really busting their ass, and they get their ass shot at and mortared and everything else, you know. Not as much as urban like Iraq is now,
mm-hmm.
because we're in different terrain, but, you know, without them, you're nothing.
Mm-hmm.
You can't survive. They used to bring out to the grunts, because the grunts would stay out 2, 3, 4 weeks. They'd bring out a sling load mm-hmm. underneath a chopper,
mm-hmm.
and it'd be all brand new uniform. Okay? What you do is you take off the one you got and the one you're carrying, you put on a new uniform. And nobody takes the new boots unless yours are really destroyed, because the last thing you want is any new boots. But and once in a great while, they'll, when the terrain's right, situation's right, they'll fly you out a hot meal. But you know, a grunt. Statistics have proven, and I can send you this in black and white, that the average age was not 19. It was 22 years old. Racial-wise, we outnumbered every other race. The other thing was that in the entire time a grunt spent in World War II or Korea, the average day spent in combat for them was 44. The average grunt that spent a year in Vietnam was 242 days of seeing combat. That's a hell of a lot of difference.
Yes.
I mean, there were some big battles during the war, World War II in Korea, but that's just what they were. You know, big battles at that time for so many days, but in an average of the time they spent in all of World War II, it might have been 44 days in combat. Well, you had 365 days in Vietnam, and you average about 240 to 242 days in combat. So, you know, and so it was a stressful thing. And then, of course, you get, you knew you only had to be there for a year. I think that's what could have been different. Of course, you don't want to leave them there, you know, for 2 years or 3 years, but there was guys that spent, I know guys spent 7 years there, you know. I'd probably still be there, you know. I mean, I tried to stay there. I felt that's where I should be. If I'm going to be in the Army, I should be where the war is, you know. When I went to extend my third time, they said, you can't. And I said, why? They said, well, see, what they did was, because of the draftees only having to serve 24 months, by the time they went through training and a year in Vietnam, they'd wind up with 7 or 8 months. So there's no sense in really sending these guys back. So they'd let them extend for a nice job in the rear until they had 179 days left. Then they would out-process them back to the States where they could get out of the service 6 months early. Now, in my situation, when I went to extend, I was enlisted, though. But they said, you only have 150 days. You shouldn't even be here. You could have got out of the Army. I said, well, if I wanted out of the Army, do you think I'd be extending? I said, so add 30 days or 60 days or 90 days, whatever. I said, you know, because I want to stay, you know, go over to SF. Well, this went on for 2 or 3 days back and forth, and they said, well, nothing we can do about it. You're going to Fort Bragg. I said, no, wait a minute. Wait a minute. You can't keep me here in Vietnam because I'm supposed to be out of the Army, but you're going to send me to Fort Bragg where by the time I go home and go on leave, I'm going to have like 120 days left. This is stupid. I want to get out of the Army. They said, well, you can't. You already got orders. I said, told about a catch-22. I was like, this is totally unbelievable. I'm trying to stay here and go. I've already been accepted to Special Forces LERPs over in where I was. We work with them in Pleiku. And you're denying me the right to stay here because I don't have enough time left in the Army. However, you're going to send me back to the United States to do what, 110 days? I said, this is stupid. Well, it didn't matter. That's what they did.
So let's go back to those first few months there in country. Can you tell me about some of your first missions going out with 101st and what you guys
did?
Well,
like I said, I was, well, what we did is when we get up to Quang Dong, we were going out on night patrols trying to find out what was happening was the VC would get in between the perimeter and the guys on the outer perimeter.
Right.
And they fire at both of them. and then they get out of the way.
Right.
So then the perimeter's unloading on to this unknown force, and the unknown force is unloading onto the perimeter. And they had us shooting at each other until somebody realized, you know, I'm being new, I'm not realizing what's going on, that this is what they're doing. They're running these little sappers that get through, and they fire up both sides, and then they take off. And then by the time you get done shooting at each other, somebody might get killed.
Mm-hmm.
So what we did, our mission was to go out on the beach and along the beaches, because that's we thought the only way they can come in, because we were blocking the inland, was. But how would they get in through the beach?
Mm-hmm.
Well, make a long story short, we had there was a like a hill, a big hill, not a mountain, I wouldn't call it, several hundred meters down from where our stuff was on the beach. And I was on patrol one night, and we went out there with Starlight scopes. And what we did is we kept an eye on this hill, because we knew our guys were on the top. Well, come to find out, I was seeing, I said, man, I see somebody. And they said, wait, let me see. Yeah. They were in the bottom of this hill, which mm-hmm. was actually in the ocean. There was a cave. And what they were doing was coming from the other side of the hill, you know, and into the cave. And then at night, they come out into the cave, get in between us, and, you know, start up, and then they get back in.
Mm-hmm.
And all I could see at that distance was figures, you know, and the only reason it was because they had to come on the beach a little bit, which was illuminated, and the Starlight scope picked it up.
Mm-hmm.
So we reported that, and we wanted to go forward, and they said, no, just stay in place and watch, you know. And what they did was, because they had to be careful, because our guys were around the, you know, crest and top of this hill, so they didn't want to throw in any artillery or anything like that yet. They mm-hmm. wanted to see what was going on. So what they did was the very next morning, they must have sent guys from up on the hill down there, okay? And needless to say, they were gone. But what they did was they set explosives all around there and actually collapsed the cave and the whole thing, and sort of tore out the terrain all around the bottom of that mountain.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, so we felt pretty good about that, that, you know, we were the ones that got them. We didn't get them. They wouldn't let us, but, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But that stopped that, and it taught me a lesson real quick, you know. And I think I know that some guys knew that this had happened in the past,
mm-hmm.
where it was my first experience, but they'll do that. They'll get in, if they can get in between two elements, they'll shoot both ways and then take off, and before you know it, by the time everybody starts talking on the radio and all, you realize you're shooting against each other. And they even do that when you're moving in a company or battalion size and your companies are split.
Mm-hmm.
They would do that, especially at night.
Mm-hmm.
They would try to get that firefight going between, you know. So that's why you always had to know where you was. Always. You had to know where you was and mm-hmm. where your friendlies were.
Was that hard to do over there?
Oh, yeah. It's really, the maps were old. You had to do... Well, in LERPS, we did aerial flyovers the day before, so we'd get a feel for the terrain that we were in, and we would mark prominent terrain features and, mm-hmm. and blue lines and stuff like that. So we knew where our primary LZ was that we were going to attempt to go into, and then our alternate, and then we plan... not a concrete, but we plan how we wanted to move depending on the mission, mm-hmm. you know, of what direction and what to look for. So that aerial flyover the day before would help you a lot. Where when you get into a higher up level and you're putting in companies, it doesn't really matter
mm-hmm.
because we never infiltrated between 11 and 2. That's Charlie's pot time. Mm-hmm. He sits up on the hilltop and he shoots up his opium, he smokes his dope, and he just waits and listens.
Mm-hmm.
Now, you try to infiltrate, you know, a 130-man company. Well, what's going to happen?
Mm-hmm.
It's going to take 10, 15 choppers. So they just sit there and wait, and when they hear it, they watch it, and they pinpoint it, and they already know you're there.
Mm-hmm.
They already know you're coming. They know where you landed and everything. So they've got you pinpointed already.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why my slogan is SALSA. Stay alert, stay alive. That's
right.
The way we felt. Because we knew all them tricks.
Mm-hmm.
We knew what they did. So we would fly in and be an individual ship, and he'd be like he'd be doing a VR. He'd dip down, then he'd come up, and he'd dip down. We might jump off, then he'd come up and dip down, then he'd dip down again, and we'd already be off and in the wood line. And if we hadn't hit anything, we'd wait like 15 minutes, 20 minutes. If everything was good, we make a combo check with a CC ship that's out of sight, and then we would start our mission.
Mm-hmm.
You know, now that didn't always work. Sometimes the one we picked was the wrong one, you know, and it would be hot. Sometimes it would be hot, and you could get out of there without getting off. Sometimes you'd get off, and it's, see, because they like shooting down choppers. That's a reward to them.
Mm-hmm.
So sometimes they would wait until that chopper's, you know, because we never let it touch the ground. I mean, you know, we jumped 6-8 feet at least, and so he could just flare and we'd be gone. And so that's, and the 101st, mostly I was doing that kind of stuff, dismounted patrols where we would lead the convoys, and then mounted patrols, and then dismounted was more running the edges of these perimeters. We would be in the middle instead of the, you know, so the VC couldn't get in. We'd run patrols and set up ambushes at the core of those, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And then I extended for the LERPs, which at that time was Long Range Reconnaissance Patrol, and was accepted to go there. However, in December 1967, the 101st went air mobile which was a smart move, due to the success of the 1st Cavalry having an air mobile division over there. When you have your choppers and you live with your choppers and they're part of your unit, and you have your aero platoons and your rifle platoons, you become very, very close-knit and well-toned because of working together all the time.
And this is the LERPs. This is not...
No, this is the way to... This is why I went to LERPs.
Okay.
Because, and this is why the 101st went air mobile.
Okay.
Because if the helicopter pilots are in the unit and they train and live with the grunts, they become, there becomes a more camaraderie, and they train together and they stay together and they're always there for you. They put you in, they take you out, they never leave you, they'll do anything to come and get you. Where
right.
We would have to rely, when I was with the 101st before it went air mobile, wherever we were going, whatever unit we were helping out, some aviation unit would show up and provide us support.
Mm-hmm.
Now, you know, overall they were good, but we didn't know them, they didn't know us. And we had problems with that with LERPs on several occasions, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Now, some LERP companies, like our sister company, they had a chopper unit assigned to them. So these guys live, ate, and breathe, and fought with each other. So they would be more liable to volunteer to take a risk or to do anything to get them guys out, or put them in, or do anything because of being, like, in the same unit. In fact, some of them, wings, belong to our association, you know, because they had worked so long with us, and they're in our association. So, you know, when they went air mobile, though, in September 67, they formed E Company 20th LERPs. They
mm-hmm.
took half of the guys from the brigade LERPs, which really raped them pretty good. as to be the leading cadre because they had at least 6 months experience. Then they took new guys and they formed the E Company LERPs up in Pleiku, up in the Central Highlands. At the same time, they were changing Air Mobile. So, to a young GI, he sees the flagpole coming, or the whole division's coming, and we're going to have Air Mobile. Well, what happened was when they arrived in country, Tet hit. So the rest of the division that was Air Mobile that came over, they did their first major fighting in Saigon, and all they were. That's where they spent almost 2 months. You know, before they even got up there to us, because they just happened to come into country when Tet hit, which really helped them to get into it and everything like that. And, you know, it helped the people down there in Saigon, because we weren't catching much of it. Once again, in fact, they were flying planes into our base camp, once again, because we weren't a strategic target like Saigon, you know, and also we were well known for defending ourselves. You know, we got some stray rockets and mortars, but nothing like they were getting, so we were taking in planes from down Saigon.
Right.
And I met up with a friend of mine who was left in September, who's in my unit, and he told me, man, you got to come up to E Company, man. This is the greatest unit going, all that. So I extended for E Company LERPs to leave the 101st, and which I did. And they got up there. Well, I got there February 10, 67. I left around the same time, February 68, right after Tet, and at the end of Tet. And that's when the division was moving up into Phan Rang and setting up, and I was leaving.
Hey, Joey, tell me, what was your experience with that?
Not much, like I said, because I was basically on my way out. Okay, so when they hit, like say December, January, I was back at base camp in December. In fact, I got to see Bob Hope.
Oh, really?
Yeah. He came to Phan Rang for the 101st.
What was that like? Do you remember?
Oh, yeah, it was great. It was women, naked women. I don't know, they weren't naked, but it was kind of like dreamlike, you know. I mean, there's Bob, you know, you're sitting right there in front of him, and he had a beautiful black girl who was famous, I forget her name, and then he had another famous star with him. He had a bunch of them, you know. Of course, I can just remember the women. And he put on just a hell of a show, and you know, he had our hat on with our, you know, it was just a great morale booster. I mean,
yeah.
It was, you know, nothing like it. It's once in a lifetime. I just happened to be there, and fortunately, you know, the rest of the guys, most of the guys were pulled in because of that being. See, that's when Tet started. See, that's supposed to be right after that is their New Year's kind of thing, and we got to see him, and then the shit hit the fan. And by then, I had only had about 30 days left or so, so I was mostly doing just perimeter guard and stuff like that at the base camp, and watching as these planes came in and out and hearing about our division down in Saigon was really taking care of business, which was good for them because they weren't in country but a couple weeks and, you know, they were at work. And that really, they got their baptism right there. So by the time they reached us after a couple months down there, you know, they had proven themselves. And there was a lot of publicity about that. Of course, they pushed that because the 101st shows up, you know, in the nick of time. Here comes, you know, they would say normally, here comes the cavalry, but now here comes the 101st Air Mobile. Okay, so it was a good introduction of the 101st and a good test of their skills and stuff like that. But my mind was set, and I knew the Lerps, I knew the guys in the Lerps, and their morale was kind of low because they had been taking some pretty bad stuff. In fact, that company and all the Ranger companies has the most KIAs. They're number one. We're 69. Mm-hmm. We're number three on the list, and out of the 13 companies. However, we probably, well, Shelby Stanton stated in Rangers of War at the end of ours that we saturated more than 14 provinces and probably killed and gathered more information and trained more indigenous personnel and provided more intel for the U.S., Thai, Arvins and Koreans than any other company, showing that a core level, we were the largest company, we had 230 men. We were allowed 230 men, showing that when used properly, the flexibility that a core level ranger, then they call it, company can produce, which when everybody tries to talk about who's the best, I just say, hey, open the book, what Shelby say, you know? Now, this Don Hall just put out this I Served. It's been out a couple years. They made a documentary and all. He was real smart. He watched us guys write these books for the last 15 years. What he did is he waited, and this whole time he waited until all this stuff got declassified, and he actually even opened his own publishing company to do this book, him and his wife. And what he did is using after-action reports from TET, because, see, they were in the two-core area, and that was the corridor from Cambodia straight through to Saigon. We were right above them in the three-core. And so he used all the after-action reports and actual historical documentation and all of, and they did, them being out there in that two-core zone, spotting all these regiments, probably helped Saigon from being overrun. And so they pushed that really big. Nothing against them, but, you know, I mean, they've only lost like seven guys. So,
right.
Yeah.
Right. Hey, Joey, could you give me an evaluation of the enemy, what your general impressions were and what you thought their strengths and weaknesses were?
Well, the way I look at it is I know that many, many times they would be there, but they wouldn't hit us. They would know that it'd be better for us just not to let, you know, even though they might have had a good shot at us, to let them get on by, because they needed that area for one reason or another. Because, like I said, if you land in a company of men, they know and they track you and they follow you, and they could, and when they hit you, they definitely made sure that they had the advantage on the large scale units.
So they would attack normally when they were ready and they felt like they could get away with it.
Right. Or you had just stumbled upon them. Okay. It's like the Battle of Dachau and Hamburger Hill. Why the hell did we ever do that? I mean, these guys were dug in there for 30 years. Okay? 30 years. I mean, you know, from the French, before the French. And then we kept on sending guys up the hill and up the hill. And you know, we were putting in everything in that thing. And these guys were so well entrenched, you know, that what I would have done is I would have pulled everybody back and I would have nuked or something. I mean, I would have, you know, arc-lighted that until there was no more mountain. That's, you know, like I Drang, the Battle of I Drang in 65 is the Mel Gibson story. We were young soldiers once.
We were soldiers once.
Yeah, yeah. That is, that was overall the worst battle. That's number one ranked battle, okay? But, of course, we were new then. Right. Number 65, you know, but when you get to 67, 68, you know, it don't take a rocket scientist to say, okay, we ain't getting up this hill, you know? Mm-hmm. I mean, we're slipping and sliding on our brother's blood. Mm-hmm. Let's back the hell up and take out the hill. We can remove this terrain feature.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's what pisses us off, because once you take the hill, then you leave it.
Right.
You leave it. Yeah, you beat them and they ran away, and now you got their stuff, but you lost all these men, and now we're going to leave the hill so they can rebuild again.
Mm-hmm.
That was the frustrating part. That's where they were smart. They would defend when they felt they could.
Mm-hmm.
They would hide when they had to. They would strike at their advantage, and or if they were cornered and there was no other way out. And when they did plan something, like when they overrun SF camps and all,
mm-hmm.
you know, this was months and months and months of planning and gathering and getting ready.
Mm-hmm.
Because they knew once they started that assault that they had better go through with it. You know?
Mm-hmm.
And that's where, when they came around and we had intercepted transmissions, you know, you have linguists that intercept this transmission,
mm-hmm.
That the basically LERP teams, where they whatever they call them, were in the area beyond the alert, and they actually had hunter-killer teams develop to come and find us, because they knew if we found them, we had the authorization, which not many people did, to call in everything from an artillery on up to a B-52. So they knew if they hit us, they had to knock us down and out quick,
mm-hmm.
or they were going to pay.
Mm-hmm.
And we did lose teams. Our company, thank God, never lost an entire team, but there are several companies that lost entire teams.
Right.
You know, I mean, 5-6 men. And, you know, I've been up against, you know, I mean, because the chopper pilots would tell you later, I mean, what it was like, what they were seeing, you know, around us, you know, and you're in the middle of all that. And you know, they're like, oh, my God, you know, if you guys only knew. Well, I'm glad we didn't know, you know. There's a lot of stories like that, but several teams, and when you move into what I was going into next, which was Command and Control North, you had Command and Control North and South, which was SOG. They were alert teams made up of SF and indigenous personnel that would do cross-border operations.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of them never returned,
mm-hmm.
you know. Now, I can say this now, I'll say it anyway, but we were doing cross-border operations ourselves.
Mm-hmm. Your alert teams.
Yeah. Right. And into Cambodia. But they were going up into Laos, deeper in.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember on one, when we called for exfiltration, the chopper said in code, no, you're in the wrong grid, you need to be at this grid,
mm-hmm.
which was 2 or 3 kilometers away and in South Vietnam. So I said to the guys, turn off the radio. I said, don't do nothing, because I don't know what's going on, these guys don't know what the hell is going on, and we walked out. We walked out until I walked that team out. I said, we turned it off, total mm-hmm. radio off.
Mm-hmm.
And because I didn't know if we were being set up, I didn't know if somebody intercepted our transmit, I didn't know what was going on,
mm-hmm.
because the pilots were briefed, you know. And what had happened, and this was one of our biggest shortcomings, besides our sister company who had aviators, is that they changed pilots in the middle of the mission.
Hmm. Why would they do that?
Because they could. And the people who were above us, we might be attached to the 25th Infantry or whatever, did not understand our mission and our what they were compromising.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? And it was just poor leadership and lack of leadership for the people who were running our company. But, you know, we had a major. We had a major for, you know, a commander. But up there at out in the middle of the bush, you might have a captain there working with their S2 and S3, and when the colonel, their colonel says, well, our men need this ship, well, I've called for medevac, and they say there ain't no medevac.
Mm-hmm.
You mean there ain't no medevac, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And we'd have to take them out on wounded guys out on McGuire Ridge and rope ladders. I mean, you know, that was, you know, the biggest thing that hurt us. And, but when that's why we got hit that day, is because when we found that bunker, we hadn't found anything, but I had found the markings, where they were marking and leading, and I said, we all felt that this is it, and it's getting dark, so we went around the side of the mountain and got in the thickest stuff we could. Well, they knew we were there, and they didn't want us to, you know, get any closer. So what they did is throughout the night, I don't know how, but they're quieter than a snake.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they crept up on us, and you know, at first light, right before first light, they hit us, and you know, we were just, you know, basically ready to be overrun. I mean, we were sitting on the side of the mountain, so the choppers can't land.
Mm-hmm.
I called for medevac. They were refueling. I said, wait a minute, you know. And I had to take out my dead team leader on a McGuire rig, which is just three pieces of nylon and wrist strap, and the two new guys, and pulled them out on that. And they went rolling, tumbling down the hill because the guy didn't tie it right until the knot grabbed. And then I had to get out the other two guys on a rope ladder and try to hook the equipment on the bottom of that. And one guy scampers up there, and then the other guy falls off, and he rolls down the hill. And, you know, it's a nightmare, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But they weren't going to let us, even though, you know, I called in everything, artillery and all that kind of shit, and the gunships are running and all that. We probably didn't put a dent in it because it was definitely underground.
Mm-hmm.
Now, they said that they were going to, this is all you hear, they're sending in a company to, you know, investigate and to, you know.
Mm-hmm.
We got credited for like 18 kills or something, I don't know, something like that, but, you know, who knows. Now we have been sent in at times to do, in fact, I was returning from a mission, and these guys started jumbling around up front and all that stuff, and the chopper was hit, from some other unit. And he looked at us, I said, let's go, we'll go in, you know. And so we went around, we circled it, and we seen the choppers were there, you know, and you know, we couldn't get down. There was no way down. We had no rope ladders or nothing. So we stayed with them as long as we could till the gunships came in. And then what they did is they, I told them, if you have to, I said, you know, we'll drop some, you know, charges down there.
Mm-hmm.
And we'll blow a hole in there and we'll get in. But we won't leave them, you know. And so we stayed with them until the gunships come in and circled them, and then the search and rescue come in, you know, the guys with the ropes and all that, and then we took off.
Mm-hmm.
And them helicopter pilots never forgot that. I mean, they, you know, we told them, go, we'll go in,
yeah.
You know, we'll go in right now.
Yeah.
We just couldn't get down in there. But there was a couple guys alive. I don't know how many lived, but, you know. So,
Joey, can you describe, like, a typical alert mission? I mean, what were you all doing? What exactly was your basic mission?
Okay. It started off as long-range reconnaissance, meaning that there was intel given down from higher headquarters that there was activity or troops or some target in this location, and no friendlies were there.
Mm-hmm.
And rather than send in a company and all that kind of stuff that would alert everything, we would go in and we would sneak around in their backyard for 2 or 3 days and try to verify the fact that there is something there. And if there was, then we would take whatever actions were needed.
What do you mean? What kind of actions would you take if you found them?
Well, if there was well-used trails, we'd set up ambushes. And if they happened to come by, we'd, you know, let them have it. Or if we came across something where it was a base camp or something like that, we would make the decision whether we were going to, you know, try to get closer or pull back and, you know, let them know what was going on and get a reaction for it. There was a time when we were doing roller coasters, you know, up a mountain, down a mountain, up a mountain, down a mountain, and the drag man felt we were being followed, so we did a loop around and winded up. We went down the hill and then we did a 90 and went back up the hill and came down the hill. When we came down, it came back up the hill, we started hearing this firing, and not 200, 300 meters from us, it was a platoon or so shooting rockets and RPGs and mortars at the hill where they thought we had just come down, which we did the first time. But we had went behind them and sort of, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
It's an old trick, and it worked. And so we just laid where we were, and we called in the jet fighters and told him what was going on, and I'll never forget this as long as I live, because he looked me right in the eyes. I know he couldn't see me, but he knew where he was, and we pinpointed them, and perfect, and he came in, and he came screaming down the valley in between the two mountain tops, and we were sitting on the side. And he looked right at my eyes, or ours, and smiled as we seen his big 500-pound bomb being launched. And I swear he looked right at me.
Yeah.
He knew whereabouts we were, but he was just smiling when he dropped that sucker. And boy, it hit. Another one came in, it hit, and there wasn't a peep. So we said, BDA, that bomb damage assessment. And the bird dog was up in the air. He, you know, the little pipe, Cessna 182s, you know. The unit said they wanted to do a BDA, and thank God the bird dog said, there's nothing there. Don't waste your men's time. I can guarantee you I'm flying treetop level. They're gone. You know?
Yeah.
So, and we got like 22 or 28 for that. They sort of, you know, estimate. He flew around and said, they're gone. He said, everything is blown to shit, and I can see them laying there. And, you know, he said, you don't need to send them in there. That's basically, that ain't how they talk. But that's basically what came on, and we just went on up and continued our mission.
Tell me about, like, what kind of equipment you all would take on these missions. I guess it depended on where you were going and what you were doing. But what would your uniform look like?
Well, uniform would fit the terrain. Now, when the 101st LRPs, they would go as far as putting on black pajamas, conal hats, sandals, NVA, web gear, AK-47s, the whole thing. They were going where there was no friendlies. So they knew that there wasn't the least chance of them running into anything but enemy. So what had the enemy do? If you happen to pop up in front of each other, he hesitates.
Right.
Just for that split second.
Yeah.
okay?
And that's enough to buy time.
That's enough, yeah. Now, on the other hand, if somebody screws up because of these old maps and they don't know where they're at and they don't know how to pinpoint themselves and all, it can get you in a world of hurt, you know?
Mm-hmm.
But there was times what we would do is a bird dog would fly out sometimes and we would use a mirror and I'd just flash the mirror. Okay,
mm-hmm.
and I'd clock him in, and then he would, when he'd be flying directly over me before he hit our position, I would say, like, bingo, and he'd tilt his wings and just do a fly around.
Mm-hmm.
He'd give us a 10-digit coordinate,
mm-hmm.
so we would know exactly where we're at, you know. And we were usually, I would say, really close to where we thought we were,
mm-hmm.
you know. I mean, we weren't 1,000 meters away, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
If you're within 300, 400, 500 meters, you're doing darn good,
mm-hmm.
you know.
Mm-hmm.
But when you had the opportunity, we would do that. And, you know, I've done that and it worked, and, you know, them bird dogs, they just keep flying around, and they were used to that. They're used to a single chopper flying around. And same way with when we did boat infills. They're used to a single boat doing patrols every night, you know, humdrum thing. They know when the high, when he's going to come and all. So,
mm-hmm.
you know, we get on the back of these boats and, you know, when they do a turn, we get off and go in by water, mm-hmm. which is kind of freaky.
You want to tell me about what that kind of mission was like?
Pardon me?
Tell me what that kind of a mission was like when you would go in by water.
Well, let's back up
okay.
and tell you with the equipment.
Yeah, please.
Okay. Equipment, basically, everybody carried, you know, maybe 3 days of rations, and we break it all down, and we put like a lerp in the pocket, and we mix it up, and so it'd be wrapped up, and then, you know, we eat on the run,
mm-hmm.
okay? And I carried about, let's see, 7, 14, around 28 magazines. That'd be 2 ammo pouches. That's, we put 4 in, staggered with tape to grab a one on top. That's 5, 10, 15, 20.
Mm-hmm.
And then at least a minimum of 1 bandolier of 7, maybe 2 bandoliers.
Mm-hmm.
Excuse me. And, then we'd all have claymores and C4,
mm-hmm.
Where we would use to put the claymores out at night, pre-positioned. Sometimes we'd daisy chain them.
Right.
So if you blew one, or, you know, all of them would go off. And we carried regular HE grenades, smoke grenades, and white phosphorus,
mm-hmm.
hand grenades, these were, you know, by hand. Then, no uniforms, maybe a pair of socks or something like that, a poncho liner to keep warm, extra radios,
mm-hmm.
We have an IRC 10, which is, a special radio that when turned on, you can't hear it, but it sends out a distress signal within a 5-mile radius,
mm-hmm.
And any aircraft or something like that could pick up on that.
Mm-hmm.
So with your rations, and remember we had tea rations in them days, but we didn't have to use them, thank God. We had lerps, which were dehydrated food, so everything was light. So you could mix it up in the morning, you know, and, you know, eat some of it and put it in your side pocket, and then, like, cook. You didn't want to do cooking. Sometimes, depending on where you was and where the wind blows in the terrain situation, you might take a piece of C4 and heat up some coffee or water sometimes.
Mm-hmm.
99% of the time, you didn't smoke. You never talked. You never spoke. You always hand on signals, or it would be a whisper in the ear,
mm-hmm.
you know, and we'd move very, very slow, very, very cautiously, and for short periods of time. We'd stop and we'd move.
Mm-hmm.
We'd stop and we'd move.
Mm-hmm.
You know? And it was normally Americans are not very patient. So if you didn't have, that's what you had to have patience, because you might stop, and once you stop and you set up, you know, you make one adjustment, that's it. You can't be moving around, nothing. You just sit and you freeze in that position.
Mm-hmm.
And I've had it where I was sitting there, I leaned against a tree, and I could hear this rubbing against the tree and
mm-hmm.
pounding. And so I started hitting, there was a new guy with us, and I started pounding the dirt. And pretty soon, a deer, there were small deer over there, a little baby deer started coming, and the guys were like shocked.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, we were all canned in, but we were scummy, dirty, smelled like it and all. And the deer came within, I would say, not maybe 10 foot. And, you know, he's, you know, then he must have caught the scent or whatever. He was right there, right in the middle of, you know, these mm-hmm. guys were like, I can't believe this, but he was calling his mom. You know?
Yeah.
And by, you know, thumping his thing and all that. And then he just, he didn't even dart away. He just sort of like looked around and turned and took off, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And so that's when you feel good. You know you're good then.
Mm-hmm.
You know when the animals don't know you're there,
mm-hmm.
then you feel pretty confident. You have a good team.
Yeah. How long would it take for you guys to have that kind of level of secrecy and synergy and coordination to do something like that?
Well, this is the problem we have. Once you get on the team
mm-hmm.
and you start working together,
mm-hmm.
it starts meshing together.
Mm-hmm.
Remember, we formed in 67 and half the company had been in country 6 months.
Mm-hmm.
Meaning, February, March, 6 months later, that half of that company could be leaving. So, in the management process, within 90 days, they should have started receiving new replacements. Because we had a TO&E of 7 6-man teams in 4 platoons.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? Well, we were down to 4, maybe 5 5-man teams, if we were lucky. You know, you got guys on leave, you got guys in the hospital, you got guys on R&R, this, that, the other thing. And they did not manage the transition well.
Right.
Fortunately, now some guys extended. So that took up some of the slack. But in their, I don't know, maybe they did and I don't know about it, but within 90 days, we should have started receiving a lot of new guys,
mm-hmm.
because within 90 days after that, half of the company could have went home
mm-hmm.
that were left, because their year was up. And that really started hitting us around when I got there in March, April, because the guy who told me all about the company and everything like that, you know, when I got there, he got killed like 6 days prior, you know. And what a way to start. Here you're going to see one of your best friends that got you, and, you know, he was dead. And he was had 30 days left. And when you have 30 days left, you're not allowed to go out on mission. You're can be a hindrance to the team.
Right.
And basically, you know, he said, oh, come on, guys, let me go out one more time. And everybody said, all right. Well, here, they made contact, and as they were doing a peel off, you know, one guy fires them back and forth.
Mm-hmm.
Johnny went forward. He just ran forward.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, there was nothing they could do. They couldn't stop him. He just ran forward, and, you know, they fought, and they finally got exfilled. And they went back the next day, and they found him. There was some dead goops, and he was all thrown up. When they inventoried his stuff, come to find out the $7,000 that he had saved up, his mother had given to his younger brother for college or something, and basically he went out there to die.
Really?
Yeah.
He knew it.
Yeah, that's what happened to him, and then it was a law. No one was 30 days or less. I mean, nobody was to know any better, and he never let on. It was when they inventoried his stuff, you know, and consolidated all, they found the letter.
Mm-hmm.
And it was saying that, you know, took $5,000 so that your brother could do this, do that. And I just felt like, yo, Tom,
mm-hmm.
That's what we figured. That's what the LT told us, you know, that that's why he went forward. He was on the death wish, you know,
because
mm-hmm. he was too damn smart and too damn good. He'd been over there for almost 2 years.
Mm-hmm.
And there was, and you don't leave a ranger, and the team that was there, they couldn't, you know, mm-hmm. they couldn't get, they were being pushed back, and they were peeling off, and when his turn to peel, he went forward,
mm-hmm.
you know, and he just went in there and fought until he died.
It was way out of character, basically, for him. That's
For anybody.
Yeah.
You don't do that. You know, I mean, it's not like, you know, you're taking over a machine gun nest or something. These guys are coming at you.
Mm-hmm.
You peel off, and then what you try to do is get enough distance so you can start dropping stuff like mortars or artillery in between you or gunships to cut you off. And then, because Charlie knows if he gets inside close enough, you can't call in that stuff.
Right.
I mean, we call in stuff, and they'd say, that's a danger close. And I said, that's a damn roger that. Shoot the shit.
Mm-hmm.
You know, because they're
mm-hmm.
coming.
Mm-hmm.
And we'd have artillery shit splashing all over us, you know. You know, shrapnel and stuff coming right through the damn trees. But we didn't, you know, hell, they were coming.
Right.
You know, so, but the guy would say, I say again, that's danger close, and we'd be screaming. Now, I say again, shoot that shit.
Mm-hmm.
And so they'd shoot it,
mm-hmm.
you know, and so, you know, it depends on, sometimes we'd wear the green camouflage, sometimes we'd wear the tigers,
mm-hmm.
It would depend on the terrain.
Mm-hmm.
But then it led on to bigger and harder missions, snatch missions, go out and try to actually get a POW.
Right.
Or get a certain person.
Right.
They were doing double teamers, where they would take two teams, put them together, load them up with a couple 60 machine guns, and they were hunter-killer teams. They were going out and purposely seeking out, you know, setting up ambushes and looking for them and making contact.
Hey, Joey, let's take a break just for a moment. This is Dr. Richard Barone. I'm continuing my oral history interview with Mr. Joseph J. Welsh, better known as Joey or Brasso. Joey, you're in Castroville, Texas. I'm in Lubbock. And today is September 6, 2005. And we are continuing our accounting of what you were doing in Southeast Asia. And I wanted to pick up where we had left off back in May. And we had gotten you into the LRPs, and we had talked about some general things. And I wanted to ask you about some of the missions and really, what did you see, first of all, as the purpose or the goal of the long-range reconnaissance patrol teams? You know, what do they tell you what you're supposed to be doing out there?
Okay, well, they originally had LRPs when they went over there, but only at brigade level, like 173rd. Now, that was long-range reconnaissance patrol.
Mm-hmm.
it became evident that they needed somebody out there to play the same game because they had been there too long.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, they'd been there living there 30 years, you know.
Yeah.
They'd sit on the hilltop and watch 8 or 10 helicopters dropping off troops. They could do whatever they wanted. But they basically every division over there, brigade, mm-hmm. some of them detachments.
Mm-hmm.
There was a total of 13. One was the only National Guard unit to serve in Vietnam and serve 1 year, and mm-hmm. it was a LRP company.
Mm-hmm.
But there was 13 that were, you know, original, and they were long-range recon patrol.
Mm-hmm.
attempt you'd be like, hey, Brewer's 101st long range recon patrol. Okay, when they first gave us over there.
Mm-hmm.
What happened was, he expanded it more, and they wanted somebody that would work at a corps level.
Mm-hmm.
Now, you know, it was cutting quarters, corps 1, 2, 3, and 4. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
And so, since the Marines had one primarily tied up, they established a corps level, which was the largest company of 240 men,
mm-hmm.
By taking half of that men from the 101st and really ripped them out pretty bad. But they were just going air mobile at the same time. This mm-hmm. is 1967.
Okay.
At that time, I was in the scout and was planning on going to Brigade Lurks for one of my extensions. But since they went air mobile and the Lurks weren't, you know, like they used to be, a friend of mine who was one of the guys that left in September 67 to go form told me, you know, hey, you got to come up here. This is great. Everybody's up there.
Mm-hmm.
So that's what I did. I extended for there.
Mm-hmm.
And their assignment basically was, and this was one hell of a unit. It was the largest one, and 2-4 was the Central Highlands, right?
Mm-hmm.
All the way across.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, about right next to the last Ho Chi Minh Trail, and pretty big area.
Mm-hmm.
But our unit was assigned with, man, highly trained and motivated soldiers. Most of them have been over there at least 6 months, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Then we had that, they had to undergo an intensive selection program before they were even assigned.
Mm-hmm.
And it was all volunteer that we could quit at any time.
Why did they make it all volunteer?
Well, I was a four-time volunteer. I volunteered for the Army. I volunteered for Vietnam, jump school. I volunteered for Vietnam, and then I volunteered for LERPS. There are certain things like jump school, being airborne, you can quit. Special Forces, you can quit.
Mm-hmm.
All right?
Mm-hmm.
Because they don't want you there, you know. But you can volunteer, but only certain are selected, you know.
Right.
And most of these guys, you know, organized to provide long-range reconnaissance, surveillance, target acquisition. And we also did special type missions on a corps level basis.
Okay.
And we usually operated in 4 to 6 man teams. But we also had the capacity, the way they trained them up, as a platoon size force, and we could conduct regular recon in force missions.
Mm-hmm.
And at times we were attached to special forces units. And we were all trained by them at MACB Reconnaissance School, which was a requirement. If you didn't get peered out, you went on a couple missions, and if everyone felt that you was good, then you stayed and went to Reconnaissance School.
Mm-hmm.
Otherwise, you left.
Right.
I mean, they would just walk, put a report on you. I mean, and some guys quit. They just, you know, it's nothing but my slogan is salsa.
Right.
Stay alert, stay alive.
Uh-huh.
Okay? Because if you have a really good functioning team, right, that's worked together,
mm-hmm.
and has the proper support, you've got a real darn good chance of getting in there and doing what you got to do and getting out.
Mm-hmm.
You're not coming in on 80 choppers and you're not beating the bush and everything like that. However, if you get, you know, bump into something, it's going to be a beehive, you know,
mm-hmm.
and you know, teams that went and never come back.
What? Tell me what kind of makeup the team would have. I mean, how many people usually, and what were the different roles?
Okay, there was just, well, in our TONE, we were authorized 7 6-man team in 4 platoons. Okay.
Okay.
And each, right, it was tailored that so many teams would be on supporting teams out there. The other ones would be on rest, and then they would rotate. Of course, that was only on paper.
Okay. Right, right.
And so you had 6 men, and the team leader should have been an E6 slot, assistant team leader E5. Then you had your senior scout, E4, E3, you know, and RTO and stuff like that. But basically, that's what it was. It was team leader, assistant team leader, senior scout, who was usually your point man, and you had your scouts. And anybody could carry the radio. It was depending who the team leader felt was the most comfortable speaking with it.
So we're talking about a small group of people here.
We're talking, well, these 7 6-man teams eventually winded up being, if we're lucky, maybe 5 6-man teams or 6 5-man teams, you know, and you can't have everybody, as, you know, there's just, the reason being, and I'm sure that somebody must have done something, but when I, you know, being in an army, I realized, okay, I got this unit, 6 months of them have already, I mean, half of them, almost half of them, have already got 6 months in. They'll be leaving me in 6 months. So I've got to have everybody on their toes. And they did that in about 3 months. And that was everybody going through training at locally and then going through special forces training at the Redondo School and then actually starting to conduct missions. All right? And that was from September till December. And then January we hit Tet. That was, Tet. That's when I was transferring from the 101st, and I went home on leave afterwards, and then came to E Company. And by the time I got there, March, the guys only had maybe 4 months left, 3-4 months, you know, and people get killed, sick, they're on leave, you know, it's just winded down. Well, I just started seeing the beginning of it, all right. But they were bringing in Kid Carson scouts,
right,
which are Chuhoy.
Right.
And even though we're trained by special forces, we don't get trained like special forces get trained, the quiet professionals, you know, that realize they're a host. Realize that they're in a nation and they're the guest, okay? Even though they're doing the training and all, when you get out in the middle of an aid camp and there's 200 Vietnamese and 12 of you, you know, they could turn on you any time.
Did you all fear that? I mean, was that something that was in your mind?
These guys, believe it or not, because of their lack of experience, you know, they called everybody a gook. You know, they, you know, not everybody. And because we had a mountain yard reaction force that stayed with us with 2 SF guys and traveled with our platoon. So if we got hit, if we got in some stuff, they would attempt to get the reaction force out there so that they could, you know, either not only help us out, but go chase the people or get us the hell out of there. But that, you know, it depends. In SF, it was different because you had your yards, which had different tribes. They were okay, but when you put the yards and the Vietnamese together, it was no good. The yards did not were little people,
right.
And then the Vietnamese were city people.
Right.
It was almost a 1950s black and white, no, 1930s black and white thing.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Now, but. The yards as a single force, and some of the South Vietnamese Rangers as and the CIDG, which that was basically your group that you form, your civilian, you know, regular defense group that from that province you draw, and you know, all the guys out. You mm-hmm. get them before the VC get them.
So you guys recruited them and got them basically before the Vietnam.
Yeah, well, we had guys out there recruiting and PSYOP and all that had already been experienced. That's the way they worked it.
Okay.
It's just like when they came to get LERPs, you know.
Uh-huh.
They looked for something, you know, and, you know, basically, in the same way with today's present-day Rangers, I would look for a kid maybe 5'10", 155, 160 pounds, graduated high school, played athletics. That's the kind of kid I would be looking for.
Right.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And that's basically almost fits the mold. The average being, I think, 20 years old, 5'10", 160 pounds, something like that. You know what I mean?
Why particularly that size? What was special
because,
about that size?
Because they they're anatomically not only strong, but very, very agile compared to a guy who's built really big, okay?
Right.
Their agility is, and then they're in that, let's say, middleweight division.
Mm-hmm.
And they're not a little guy. They're not a big guy.
Mm-hmm.
They're in the middle. You know?
Right.
And so they can have a cocky attitude.
Right.
A man once said he was young, rowdy, bold, and sometimes offensively swaggering. Yet when the chips were down, he was the most soul-satisfying man, most soul-satisfying comrade a man could want on the battlefield. And that was General Maxwell Taylor
mm-hmm.
talking about the paratroopers.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, the Rangers are the ultimate in what they do. Okay,
yeah.
You know, our unit was one of the best over there. Of course, everybody's going to say they were the best, but in the time we had there, which was from September 67 till October 71,
mm-hmm.
We had saturated more provinces, worked with more U.S., Vietnamese, and ROC units,
mm-hmm.
and trained them,
mm-hmm.
and we did quite a bit. I was telling you about that book. That's
mm-hmm.
like the big key on that book is Tet.
Mm-hmm.
Because they were our sister company. They were the third Corps LERPs. There's only two Corps LERP companies.
Mm-hmm.
All the rest were under a brigade or division. You know, 82nd, 101st, 25th, 4th ID. But 1st Field Force, Vietnam, and 2nd Field Force, Vietnam, was, you know, our two guys.
Mm-hmm.
And what happened is their quarter was south of us, so they, during Tet, they caught a lot of guys coming in, and, you know, by that, you know, could have saved them getting across to Saigon, etc.
Mm-hmm.
Not saying that, you know, they didn't do well, but statistically, have you ever read Shelby Stanton's Rangers at War?
Not all of it. I've read parts of it.
If you see it, grab it.
Mm-hmm.
And it has a good chapter on every unit. And we were called the Typhoon Patrollers, okay, E Company.
Mm-hmm.
And at the end of every chapter, he gives his same bleep, you know, same format,
mm-hmm.
evaluation. And all you have to do is read the last page of every unit. And it by far, ours by far, you know, they said that if anyone proves that, that it could be done at a core level, because you need a lot of flexibility. You got people that don't know what the hell a LERP, they think it's a meal, which
mm-hmm.
it is.
mm-hmm.
You know,
mm-hmm.
I mean, that we did have some really bad times because, even though we had a representative up at their headquarters, the commanders weren't using us properly at times. And that can be very frustrating and dangerous,
mm-hmm.
you know. But
tell me how you all would be used. What were the type of missions that you would be sent on?
Well, primarily, it was reconnaissance and surveillance. Now, because we're at core level, we would receive from high headquarters that there was something going on in this area.
Mm-hmm.
There was no friendlies there,
mm-hmm.
okay? And we want you to run around their backyard and find out if what we're seeing and hearing is true.
Mm-hmm.
Okay?
Mm-hmm.
And then if it is, you get the hell out of there, and then we make a plan to go get them. That's the ideal recon.
Okay.
You know, to get in and out, find them, you know, fix them, fight them, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But most of the time, if we seen them, you know, we would definitely attempt to, you know, bring hell on their ass. And that could bring hell on your ass because, you know, you ambushed 8, and that was just the lead party of 80.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, shit.
Right.
You know what I mean?
That could be tough.
Yeah. So, you know, but that's, you know, it's still all the jungle. But I wouldn't change it for anything in the world. As much as it has, like, driven this guy, you know, he said, I want to tell this doctor, you know, that I'm ready to freaking kill somebody, okay?
Mm-hmm.
But he's just not on my plane, you know?
Mm-hmm.
So he couldn't hold it any longer, so he said, well, that's it, because, you know, he knew the routine was coming up. He was going to say, that's it. And he just stood up at him and just yelled really loud into his face. And said, that's how I feel, Doc, and walked out. He's crazy, you know. And jumped on his Harley and
uh-huh.
drove away,
uh-huh.
you know. But he couldn't get it out. You know, he never could tell anyone how he felt,
mm-hmm.
you know.
Mm-hmm.
He could think it, you know. And then again, were they because believe me, when we came back and people started this shit and they started becoming, a habit, they were saying no bullshit, you know, because they hadn't worried about the Korean and Second World War and all that. Of course, they came home to a welcoming committee, too. Our guys came home kind of, you know, unannounced, you know, and didn't want to be known.
Mm-hmm.
So it was, it was entirely different. When I came over from the Gulf, it was like, I mean, a superhero's welcome. And I actually snuck home from Vietnam.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they snuck us
mm-hmm.
Out the doors and don't stop anywhere and do this and get on the plane and,
mm-hmm.
you know. But
can you describe kind of like when you guys would go on reconnaissance missions? How would you operate? I mean,
okay, well, once you develop a team, you develop an SOP for how your team reacts, you know, and it comes from everybody's training and experience, and your equipment is packed so that you can jump up and down, there's no movement. You have to be, and which Americans aren't, very, very patient. When you go through school, you sit down, you can make one movement, and then if you make another movement, you're thrown out of the class. And you might sit there 15 minutes, you might sit there for an hour and a half. You never know. Okay? I mean, if a bee stinging you on your cheek, you better not move. Okay? Maybe not to that extreme, but you know what I'm saying. And it's because you have to, you know, be part of the environment. You didn't shower, you didn't clean, you wanted to be dirty. We owned the day and they owned the night. We would set up just prior to darkness in the thickest stuff we could get. Let's back up. The mission. Okay, we're on a mission that they believe that there's a communications site located in this area. All right? And they give you an approximate area. And you're going to be infiltrated on this day and exfiltrated on another day. So what you do is you put out the plans to your men of what you're going to do, and they know what to prepare and what you want, equipment they want. And then what you do is the team leader will go up and do an aerial flyover, just like a chopper's flying around, you know. The common thing every time. And that gives you a good bird's eye view of what's down there. Because you need a primary landing zone, and if you get shot out of that, most of the times they'll make you go in the primary, the alternate. And I would say, well, wait a minute, I think we made contact. Why don't you just send some guys in there? But, you know, they'd shoot around to another one. But during this time, you'd prepare where you felt, after you come back, where you felt the best way to go in and travel towards this site and recon it, and the best way to get out. And then you presented it to the team and the staff, and they say, okay, you rehearse it, you know, your little actions, and get all, you know, cammied up. We paint ourselves all up, and we wouldn't infiltrate between like 11 or 2 or 3. That's Charlie's pot time.
Between 11 p.m.?
No, in the like 11 a.m. to 2 p.m. during the hot hours. It's not a good time to go in, I feel, due to the fact that he's sitting up there, and I found him shooting opium and sitting on a hill smoking a joint. And just, like I said, it's no time to be making a 18 in helicopter assault. If it's 5 miles away, he can see you. You see? So we would try to get in earlier than that. You know, so we'd have the day to move, or sometime we would go in later. But then you've got the darkness coming on you. So we would load up, and one of the problems we had was that the three Corps LERPs had an aviation detachment assigned with them, together. They lived together, ate together, flew together. And they had some, 5 or 6 flicks and fools, I don't know, 5 or 6, gunships, which is fantastic because, you know, if you live, eat, and breathe together, you know, you become very close with your pilot.
Sure.
I mean, all the pilots were great, but every pilot that we had, we might have been attached to the 173rd working for, you know, the brigade, and they're being supported by a 155th Aviation who's from, you know, anyway, but, you know, at times that could cause a problem.
Mm-hmm.
It would have been much better to have, and we winded up with a squadron at the end, mm-hmm. actually being assigned to the squadron made it easier.
Mm-hmm.
Then we would we'd fly out and there would be a command and control ship way up in the back,
mm-hmm.
and then there would be gunships behind that. And we would do low level, we'd be flying along, and then we'd do low level flying, and he'd dip down like we were going to land, and we might land, well, we don't land, but we jump off, and call it a false insertion.
Mm-hmm.
So, because helicopters fly around so much, most of the time, you know, you had one out of three places to pick, and so, and it was all coordinated which one it would be, and then you jump off, head directly to the bush,
mm-hmm.
and he would continue to fly on, mm-hmm. and then you'd freeze, and look, listen, smell, feel what you're about. If there's no contact or no problem, and you feel settled, then you would make the commo check to the CNC ship, just a commo check.
Mm-hmm. And how would you do that?
By code.
Okay. Over the radio.
It would be like, you see, but,
uh-huh.
I mean, very, very, even with, so you can't hear the guy. He's got it cuffed and all.
Right.
And he's got the volumes on the control under everything, okay? And they would just, you know, get the commo check. If we and four times a day we sent in a situation report, and you'd just say, like, Alpha, Bravo, Charlie, Delta, and you would say a keyword or numbers,
mm-hmm.
and that'd be it. And then if the man calls you, or if you're talking to the man and you stop talking, and he'll ask a couple times, and then he'll say, break squelch twice if you can hear me, and you just squeeze the trigger.
I see.
That means you're in deep shit.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you can't talk.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so, you know, and we did not talk at all. We moved very, very, very slow and tedious. And we'd have the point man,
mm-hmm.
who picked the best route, the slack man who guided him, like, on a compass-wise, even though the point man was on it anyway. Then usually the team leader, and then the guy carrying the radio, and then the rear scout, or two rear scouts, but usually a rear scout,
mm-hmm.
and he would be actually covering our trail as much as he could. And everybody was, you know, done, everything was done by hand and arm signals, and if you move too long, you know, you're going to get noisy.
Mm-hmm.
So you take a lot of breaks, and you're always watching the map because they were so old, and you want to make sure that you know where you're at and where you're going, and so you're trying to find, you know, a blue line, like, that can coordinate with you,
mm-hmm.
and that was one of the major problems, was how old the maps were. But
where did the maps come from?
Oh, I imagine they came from the Vietnamese army. I mean, you know, I was just down there with a map. Mm-hmm. You know, like in any unit you go to, here's the map you're using, you know. But, mm-hmm. of course, we were very compact and lightweight as much as we could, even though we had to carry a lot of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Like, you know, it would be sealed in acetate. It would only be as big as, you know, maybe twice as big as the area we worked in.
Mm-hmm.
We weren't carrying no big, you know what I mean?
Because,
mm-hmm. you know, forget about it. If it's 5 clicks, you know. So what we would do is move along, and if we felt everything was going good, fine. If we came on a trail, depending on the mission,
mm-hmm.
we might follow the trail. I have stepped on trails, but not traveled on.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Right. How do you do that? How do you learn that? What, is this something that's taught you at recon school? Or?
Oh, yeah. Well, you don't want to be on the trail because, you know, that's where the enemy travels.
Mm-hmm.
But sometimes you're forced to get from point A to point B. The best way is to get the hell down the trail. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
But actually, in real life, the way that they do it is two guys come up to security, and then one will go across and hope about security, then another, and the last one will, as he's going across, he's got a brush with him, and he wipes the footprints. I mean, you know, that's really getting into it, but some of them are beaten down hard clay, some of them are rocky, some of them are muddy, you know, it depends. But then, if it looks like a good place, and maybe if it's getting dark, then we would set up an ambush, okay?
Mm-hmm.
Where we would likely think that, you know, they might come. And even if we didn't, we would set up in as thick as we could, and we'd set out claymores around us, so that if we were hit at night, we could ignite the claymores.
Mm-hmm.
And when it first started, Charlie was pretty darn good. He would come up, pick up the claymore, and turn it around. And, you know, it never happened to anybody in our unit, but I know it happened to people, and wham, you know, that's how quiet he was. You know, he lived there.
Yeah.
He was in his backyard.
Yes.
So we would daisy chain them together, and we would also sometimes put, you know, a trip there, or something that, you know, if he messed with it, he would get a big surprise,
mm-hmm.
you know.
Yeah.
And we daisy chain some of them so that when we ignited one, the jet cord would go two different directions and ignite the other four. And it's a pretty awesome, you know, anti-personnel mine.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's got like 200 ball bearings in it, and it, you know, you just can't be behind it.
Mm-hmm.
That would be when they were in the kill zone. We would, you know, set up claymores, and then we would have a guy on each side, you know, front security. Then if sometimes we would go heavy and we'd take a 60. You know, for pig, an M60 machine gun,
mm-hmm.
you know. It evolved into where we started doing a little bit more, and we'd go out and we would set up target personnel detectors. These little things that they gave us that we put in the ground,
mm-hmm.
and, you know, sensors, which is pretty neat, you know. If you don't get caught.
Right.
And then sometimes you were sent out to try to catch a prisoner, a snatch, or to go get a certain target. And we did, you know, I've been on a reaction force. The team that's on support and in the back, and you have your reaction force, The guys are in some big shit, and they got air support going and all, but it's still not working. Then, you know, these 40 or 50 guys are trained and ready. They get on, and then they come in from another angle and then fight their way in, you know. And then it got to be, depending, this is again, once, depending upon who you're with, we'd have two teamers. So where there would be like 10, 12 guys, a couple machine guns, and, you know, you went out there and you went out there hunting.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm.
It would depend. But sometimes you would need that because, you know, you was in some really thick stuff or there was a lot of activity going on. Mm-hmm. So if you had two good teams that... If you had a good two good teams that worked together in the, you know, as a team, and they could join together as a team because they're in the same platoon, you could have a very, very powerful 10, 12 man force and very, very smart.
How often did the enemy know that you all were there?
Oh, quite a bit, I'm sure, because I've seen him, he's seen me, and we kept on going. Wasn't no sense in shooting at him, I couldn't hit him, and, like, I knew my shit was up, you know.
Yeah.
And I'm sure he's seen us more than we know about, but it behooved him, and that's the way he picked the fight.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he might see the infantry coming in, but if they were going the opposite way of where he had anything, he wasn't going to go chase them all the time. He would let them go. Or he would organize to strike them at his advantage.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and basically, you know, after a while, when we caught some prisoners and all that, they had trained, whatever they call us, ranger killer teams or whatever, to hunt us down. And there was supposed to be rewards for us and all that, you know. But you hear that from everybody.
Was that true?
I'm damn sure it was true about helicopters because, the last thing you want to do is when a helicopter is hovering is stand up with an AK-47 and shoot at it.
Mm-hmm.
Because you know you're catching hell. But if you knock it down and you get $1,000 or whatever, you know, there must have been some kind of incentive because I wouldn't stand up. I might shoot at it, but I ain't going to stand. But I was,
right.
You know, they love to catch them choppers at their vulnerable part and time because they've won. Especially if you're half loaded or you haven't left and, you know, they've won. They've knocked the chopper down and, now you've got more injured and of course that brings in the more gunships, but they might move closer.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so, you know, they did play the game. As I was saying, we would set up prior to darkness, and so we would be all settled in and in the thick as you could get so you couldn't see your hand, if possible. And we would wagon wheel and do hour and a half, whatever, of so-called watch. And then, you know, before it got daylight, we were all up, alert and ready,
because
that's when Charlie's moving. He's already packed up and he's moving.
And is your object to count heads or?
No. What I'm saying is he will come during the dark and set up, and he'll leave during the dark, the twilight, you know, the dark. Because he owned the night. It was his backyard. I mean, we've been stumbling all over. Not that bad.
Mm-hmm.
But compared to how they could move, especially if they were in an area where a division or something like that had been for years, they knew every trail, which way it went, you know, they knew where, I mean, when I was talking about the mission, like to go see the communication site, you know, we go out there and we get in the general area. and we hit a punji stick field.
Mm-hmm.
So that's a pretty good indication. And then I was going down the saddle, and there was about a 6 to 8 inch, maybe smaller, brush, like a small little tree,
mm-hmm.
and which I just happened to notice was cut once, and it fell,
mm-hmm.
you know, and mm-hmm. it was very clean cut, and it was pointing up to the top of the saddle, and so we take that as a sign that, I mean, we know it's cut by a machete,
mm-hmm.
you know, now, which direction is going, we just guessed.
Mm-hmm.
But it was getting late, so instead, rather than get up on top of the saddle, we went around the side and got in the real thick stuff. Well, little did we know that inside that saddle
mm-hmm.
was an underground communication thing. You could have drove a deuce and a half through it.
Wow.
You know, I mean, well, they had been there for 30 years, you know, fighting. I mean, they had... you know, hospitals underground, caches of weapons and everything.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, then that's, but when you get too close, then they gotta bite you. You see?
Yeah.
And, I think we were all right up to that time, but we should have moved real quick in the morning, and we didn't. So we eventually got hit,
mm-hmm.
but fortunately we got out of there. And then, you know, they just pulverized the whole entire area. I mean, they, you know, I've been in a place where you'd be sitting on a hill and overseeing, you know, the area around you, and then during the night there'd be, you know, bombing going on
mm-hmm.
over where you could see it,
mm-hmm.
and then the next day you see that the damn there's a hill missing, you know.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it was real beautiful. It was nice and green. Now there's this, you know, dead piece of brown spot, you know. So it can wreak havoc on your. We had a lot more psychological problems than most units. And
your unit did?
No, I'm saying these type of units.
Yes.
And that's why we're rowdy and bold and crazy, because we've got to let off the steam.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, before we go in, we get isolated. Mm-hmm. So we're not drinking or nothing, you know. And for a couple of days, we're planning and everything like that. Then when we come out, we go into what they call like detox.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, once you give you the briefing and everything, then they let you alone and do whatever you want. Because we've always got these barracks that are off in a corner somewhere. And then the next day, if the location is right, they'll let you go downtown. And, you know, the best thing to do if you're in a war, when you're not in a fighting, you should be fucking. That's mm-hmm. it.
That's what you all said?
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah. When you go over there, hell, you're an 18, 19-year-old guy, mm-hmm. and so you know, I mean, well, I had already spent 7 months in Germany, so I was used to it, but, here's a kid that's going off to war, you know, and he gets a couple of days off, and it's just like sex. I mean, you mm-hmm. know, what the hell else, you know, I mean,
mm-hmm.
you know, and, well, I was authorized, and Lerbs were authorized an two out-of-country R&Rs and one in-country.
Okay.
I was there for two tours, one of my third, and I had one out-of-country R&R.
Wow.
Well, I didn't request any.
You wanted to stay in.
Well, no. What happened was I got medevac, and I was supposed to go on R&R to Bangkok with a couple guys. But since I got medevac, I wound up getting sent on my own, and I went to Hong Kong. I had a good time and all, but staying there the third time, I wasn't going home on leave or nothing. I was just staying 6 months.
Mm-hmm.
Now, some guys, what they did eventually once they got the routine down was, if they were changing units, they would go to the unit for 30 or 40 days, and then they'd go home for 30 days and come back. So they would get settled in,
mm-hmm.
you see.
Mm-hmm.
Or a lot of guys wouldn't go home. They'd go to Australia, Bangkok, whatever.
Mm-hmm.
They'd take 2 or 3 weeks. Because every 6 months you extend for, you get a free 30-day leave,
mm-hmm.
you know.
Mm-hmm.
Really at the beginning when the advisors started, they were from Okinawa and the 46th company in Thailand. And that was the golden triangle. I mean, he was either in Vietnam or back in Thailand or in Vietnam or in Oki, and they were doing 6 months rotations at the very beginning. And then you would spend 2 years on Okinawa, and then you'd go to a year in Vietnam, and then you'd go to maybe a couple years in Thailand. Geez, I missed out on that.
Well, I assume that was by choice. I mean, you wanted to...
Oh, yeah, because you don't want to go back to the States. Oh, God, no.
Why not?
Well, if you're in the army and you like it, and there's a war going on, I just felt that that's where I wanted to be. Now, there was a lot of times when I said, I got to get the hell out of here, but overall, I still wanted to stay. Now, if you can bear with me just for a minute.
Sure.
I was a regular army. I did that on purpose, so I was guaranteed to go to jump school.
Right.
So I enlisted for 3 years. Okay. Mm-hmm. Now, right, 2 weeks before basic training was over, they said, now we had draftees that were coming in for 2 years. They said, anybody wants to go to jump school, raise your hand. I said, so I raised my hand, mm-hmm. you know, and then we went down and took PT tests. So these guys didn't even enlist for it. You see,
mm-hmm.
it just so happened that whenever they needed volunteers, they just took the guy. But anyway, I'm still glad I did it because it gave me the time and I was guaranteed it.
Sure.
But when I graduated, I just hit that class that they said, wait, mm-hmm. Every one of them men will get on a plane tomorrow and go to Europe and fill in some spots, 155, which probably really helped me because I spent 7 months there and all I did was train. You know, and little, I mean, you had to be there 6 months before you could even apply for a 3-day pass. I mean, it was very, very rough unit, very, very strict. Mm-hmm. You know, it was basically the, 8th Airborne of Europe.
Well, you had to be that way because you're doing these very small unit dangerous missions.
Well, no. This is when I went there from jump school, I was in a recon radar platoon, okay, but this was in Europe. But it gave me some really excellent training. You know, 7 months of training with some guys that have been in combat. So I really got an extended period of training so that I felt a lot more confident in myself, and I knew the Army so much better
mm-hmm.
that when I did go to Vietnam, it was actually, I came in the Army in February 25th, 1966, and I didn't go to Vietnam until February 10th, 1967 because I went through all the training, jump school, and I spent 7 months in Germany.
Mm-hmm.
But that 7 months really, really helped me.
Right.
Tactically and, personally, it just made me feel good because, well, I mean, of course, it's a pain in the butt, but we were constantly on alert, constantly on alert, constantly training, constantly jumping. And, you know, rather than me just going through basic training, you know, infantry school, jump school, get on a plane, and here's Vietnam.
Right.
I was just 300 to 500% better.
Mm-hmm. I mean, but, I imagine you had more confidence, more experience.
Yeah, I had more confidence. I was really, see, because when I got there, I asked them how long. Now you had to be careful how you said that, but mm-hmm. how long do I have to stay here?
Mm-hmm.
They said 90 days, and you can put in a 1049 request to go to Vietnam.
Mm-hmm.
No problem, you know. And I soldiered my ass off. I worked hard, and I learned all I could. And 90 days came, and I put in my orders, a request for orders, and I guess yeah, I ordered it. That was around September. I got there in the end of July, and I left December 19th, that same year.
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, I got home on Christmas Eve, mm-hmm. and I'd been in the Army going on 11 months then. And that was all training.
Mm-hmm.
It was all training, and it was all good. And, you know, I had a 30-day leave, and then in February I went. I didn't go with the unit. I went what we call it individual. There was a whole plane load of you, but
yeah.
you reported to either Fort Dix or down in Oakland or wherever. They wanted me to go to Oakland, and I went to Fort Dix because mm-hmm. I had been in the Army and I knew how to go early and Twix. They were sending a commo down there. Hey, we got them up here. We're just going to fly them out of here. Where I wouldn't have known that. I would have flown to Oakland. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It's just things like that that I knew. And then and they flew us there, and we were in this big replacement detachment and for 3 or 4 days, and then you could come down with your assignment. At the time, I would have wanted to go to the 173rd, and I got orders for the 101st.
Mm-hmm.
Just good, you know. But
mm-hmm.
And then when you get to your unit, you go to their base camp, and you went through a 2 week survival indoctrination and acclimatization. Getting you climatized. Acclimatized.
Right, right.
Okay, so that's what that first Christmas was, February, when we left
mm-hmm.
the United States, see?
Yeah. And that's not Vietnam weather.
Right, but even no matter what time you come in, so you would be up on the hill and you'd spend 10, 12 days up there. And, you know, training, everybody got the same training, whether he was a cook or a grunt, you know, and all the torture, all the booby traps and the snakes and the spitting cobras, and they'd let the monkeys loose. And plus, on the other side of the buildings was the guys who were leaving, you know, so mm-hmm. it was kind of a, you know, chant and shout thing.
Mm-hmm.
Although one thing that was very traditional, and I learned before I went there, and I did it on purpose, is we went over there in either khakis or greens with spit shine jump boots.
Mm-hmm.
Now, what we would do is we would, you know, when we got to replacement detachment, well, a guy came up to me. I didn't even have to do it. A guy came up to me, and he was airborne, you know, just his boots were white,
mm-hmm.
you know. And he said, what size shoes, you know. And I found a guy that matched up, and it was tradition that I gave him his boots, and he gave me his, because they fit me, and they were broken. It's kind of a weird tradition, it was actually a thing. I did it. Mm-hmm. I gave away my jump boots to a guy that wore 10 regular, and I got his 10 regular jungle boots, and boy, they were just so soft and nice, you know, even though you're going to get issued other stuff.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and then you jump there, you get your training, and then you go to your unit, and we were first brigade. We were spread out all over, you know, their missions were, well, first of all, they were very well respected by the enemy, okay? We would have rocks around our base camp in the mountains, and they would light bonfires to let them know where they were, you know?
Mm-hmm.
The Koreans would light bonfires to let the enemy say, you know, come on, you know? So we were pretty secure in them areas. Once we got to another forward support element, which could be, you know, we were on the coastline north of Nha Trang in Phan Rang, and it was an Air Force base there. That was our base camp.
Mm-hmm.
Once I was there maybe 3 weeks or so, and then I didn't see it for 7 months. Once we left, you know, we just kept on jumping from place to place, you know.
Mm-hmm.
I got met back, and then instead of sending me back, when I got back to the holding area, I told him, you know, I had orders, you know, I said I was supposed to go in TDY, but I was medevac, so they said, okay, well, you know, we'll let you go now. Since you're here, you better go. So I said, yeah, where do you got open? Hong Kong and Korea. I mean, Hong Kong and Hawaii. So, you know, the Hawaii was for married guys.
So
I went to Hong Kong, you know, spent all my money and then sold everything back the night before and partied and, you know. It was a very long year. It was a very long, long year. It was a long year. I liked in the fact that knowing I could do 6 months and either stay or 6 months and go somewhere else. And that's what I had planned on doing. That's what I was leading up to, that if you were a draftee and say you went through basic training, infantry training, your leave, or let's put you airborne, jump school, your leave, and then you went to Vietnam, you'd already done maybe 6 months of training, so you had what? 18 months left. Okay. And by the time you do a leave, you know, so you might come up with serving 12 months in Vietnam and only having maybe 5 months left to go. So they put the cutoff at 6 months, 179 days. In other words, you was worthless. It was worthless for them to send you back to the States, 30-day leave, go to a unit where in 90 days you're going to be getting out. So it was called 179-day early out. All right. And, I mean, they would take you offline and everything. I mean, feed you 12 months online. Okay, you know, go work in supply for 2 months. You did a good job, and then they would go back to the States and get out of the Army. Well, when I put in my extension, they came and said, well, you can't put in your extension. And they said, I said, why? They said, because you ain't supposed to be here. You only got 150 days left in the Army. You know, you should have left, you know, but while my records were lost and all that, I said, well, I'll try to make this quick. If I didn't want to be here, I wouldn't ask. Just extend me for 30, 60, 90 days, whatever, so I can stay. Okay? Because I want to stay, or I want to ask. All right? So they said, okay, we'll see what we can do, and then they come back and they said, oh, well, they've got you going to the 82nd Airborne. I said, no, I can get out of the Army. How can they reassign me if you just told me I can get out of the damn Army, so now I want out of the Army. You either send me to Special Forces or I want out of the Army. Because under the 179-day rule, I'm not supposed to be here. Well, you know where I winded up.
Mm-hmm.
Fort Bragg.
Mm-hmm.
You know, but I didn't go right away. I went to the up to the National Personnel Records Center and tried to fight it to go to a different place in Bragg. But anyway, I winded up in Bragg in October of 68. I did 19 months and then winded up in Bragg in October. November, December, January, February. I spent 4 months there and mm-hmm. got out. Yeah, the place just, you know, it was just terrible.
It wasn't Vietnam.
Well, see, I had critical MOS. Once you was in a, to get the reconnaissance, you had to be in alert or in eventually alert ranger recon SEAL. We had Thai, Korea, Vietnamese forces go through it with their separate instructors. And it was run by the B-52 Delta Project,
mm-hmm.
Guys that had been around for several years over there. And it was the best school that I've ever went through or seen, because it was the only school in the world where you actually had to go out in a live combat mission for 4 to 5 days and come back and graduate.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, it was very intensive. That's why you had to have at least 6 months in combat and, you know, be in a LERP unit.
Mm-hmm.
So, and the first week was just everything you can imagine. Map reading, demolitions, intelligence, and the PT was excruciating. They tried to, you know, 5 straight days, they tried to eliminate, weed out the ones, you know, real fast.
Mm-hmm.
And, but the instructors were fantastic. We, you know, we got to learn how to call and fire, how to do everything. Medics, we did IVs on ourselves, and all that kind of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And then we took that and went to the field. And I say the field, it was a, you know, pretty safe area. It was still out in their training area, over on an island. And we would do the infiltration and exfiltrations. We would do the rope ladders. We qualified and familiarized with, like 42 foreign weapons. We did patrolling and immediate action drill. What do you do here? What do you do there? Did mortars. We called in, artillery strikes. We called in airstrike. I mean, this is all happening in 10 days. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
And it was coming fast,
mm-hmm.
you know, and then you applied all that and they had you the entire time. You broke down to a 5-man team. And one special forces instructor was your team leader. But he was never your team leader. He would just be the team coordinator. And when you went on the mission, you know, someone was assigned the team leader.
Mm-hmm.
And basically he was the evaluator / I'll get us out of here. It's the last thing we do, you know.
Mm-hmm.
It was great, and they taught us, you know, how to go in by rope ladder, how to rappel in, how to go out by stable rigs, go in by water. That's how I went in. I went in by, you know, a rubber raft and did my recon and came out in a helicopter. Others went out in a helicopter and came out the water. It was just the craziest school you could ever imagine. It was just so intense. And it was hard. It was, they did, well, Special Ops does their PT different than the rest of the military, especially the Army. We do a good warm-up and stretch, and then we'll do our 5-mile run or 3-mile run or whatever. And then we'll do multiple different stations of exercise to muscle failure.
Mm-hmm.
And then we go take the shower. Next day we'll get up, we'll warm up and all, we'll throw on a 60-pound rucksack, and we'll ruck our asses off for 4 or 5 miles, then we'll come back and we'll do calisthenics till we're muscle failure. Mm-hmm. You know?
Yeah.
That's just how hard they train, but it was better that way. It's so much better to get the run and the ruck, and you're so hot,
mm-hmm.
so warm, so stretched, so ready, you know what I mean? And so what they would do is they would give us the calisthenics, and then you would have full field equipment with lock and loaded and everything, because mm-hmm. they opened the doors. You was going through the village. And they would, everybody went by and they had a 40-pound ruck or something like that, 35-pound ruck.
Mm-hmm.
And it was the sandbag or the radio. And you'd weigh your ruck and then you'd go. And when they start off at like, 2, 3, 4, 5 and then 7 miles, something like that. The first day was, just like a mile or so that they showed you the route and everything. And then it got bigger and bigger, went 2, 3, 4, 5, 7. And that's the first 5 days. And you think you're in shape, and, you know, there was guys, we have one guy and that had been over there 7 months humping the hills, and from my company that had a heart murmur, and they medevaced him, we never see him again.
Really?
Yeah.
He was gone, that was it.
No, he wasn't dead.
No, but he was... No,
yeah, it was just so intense. And so, like, the second day, G.I. Joe, when he gets a break, you're going to go out there and sit down and smoke. I couldn't even laugh because I hurt so much. So we had a Korean team there, and I was with a fellow from the 25th who had been in Korea. He's a black guy, he had an E-5 in the 25th. Infantry.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, man, I should work out with them guys. And he said, you want to? And he knew some Koreans. So anyway, I started doing that. On breaks, I would work out with them. And my pain went right away because I was, I had done martial arts before.
Mm-hmm.
Instead of, you know, doing all this crazy stuff, if you don't constantly stretch, and then, of course, they gave us chow from hell. I mean, their chow was great. And, in fact, they would have 2 warm beers every morning. The Koreans. You know.
Jeez.
It was that open, but...
Mm-hmm.
And then, you know, you your team came back after that second week, and you spent 2 days... planning your reconnaissance, and then you would be infiltrated, five-man team, I had an Australian officer, by the way, 5-man team, and the 6th man was the special forces instructor,
mm-hmm.
and one of the students was the team leader. I happened to be the team leader on mine,
mm-hmm.
and... But at any time, he could rotate you or do whatever he wanted to do. And he was interviewed on the MACV Recondo Hour. I've got like 8 hours. LERPs in Vietnam, Recondo in Vietnam, stuff like that.
Mm-hmm.
Pat, and his name is Ed Clancy.
Mm-hmm.
I'll never forget because he was... Well, maybe 5'10", 160 pounds, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But he was Burnt City. He had been over there like 32 months, something like that.
Mm-hmm.
And that's basically what they did. Is that training time was really a break for them, and they rotated in and out of there.
Joey, let me ask you about some of these other missions. You guys did the reconnaissance. What other things would you do besides reconnaissance missions?
Okay, we would do the killer teams, a two-teamer.
Mm-hmm. Which, can you describe what one of those was like?
Well, like I said, depending on the mission, you know, if you get a good area and you get in there and... you see them before they see you, it usually works out real well.
No, you were sent in to look for one person, or was it just anyone?
Well, no, it's possible that you could be looking for one person. That's, you know, what they call a snatch, or they try to snatch a prisoner. In other words, have an ambush or you know, try to find a few guys and at least bring one back, you know, or they might have intelligence that a tax man has run up and down this area,
mm-hmm.
you know. Search and rescue. If a chopper goes down,
mm-hmm.
they would send the two teams in to rappel in and secure the area. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
We had guys just run into Italian-sized base camps, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And then we've had guys set up, all of a sudden, it was like 2 o'clock in the morning, they woke me up with their hand over my mouth. And I knew that meant, you know, so I didn't move, you know, I just looked over, I didn't have to move far.
Mm-hmm.
Because about, I'd say, 35 meters, there was 8 or 10 groups sitting around a fire, talking and joking and laughing and eating. We're, you know, in this thick underbrush.
That's incredible. What do you do in a situation like that?
Well, what I did, being the medic of the team,
mm-hmm.
is, well, first of all, you feel pretty damn good that you adhered yourself that well.
Yeah.
But now you've got to get everybody alert but relaxed.
Mm-hmm.
So we had codeine, which, well, we had amphetamine codeine, but the codeine was really used to sustain cough, you
okay.
know.
Yeah.
And so what I did was I doubled the dose because I knew it would definitely knock you down.
Mm-hmm.
But I knew the adrenaline in conjunction with the narcotic effect of that hopefully would mellow them to where they could just relax, all of us. And I don't mean just cough, but, you know, just relax.
Right.
Because they eventually fell asleep a little bit, and then they packed up their stuff and started heading out. And then, you know, we just waited till they got a little bit, and then we called in the situation. We followed a little bit, and then we called in dead right on them, and we asked, do you want a BDA, damage assessment?
Mm-hmm.
And the fact is, no, I can count them from here. But, you know, and we just went about our own way.
How often does that happen?
It's only happened to me twice, only once where they actually sat at
mm-hmm.
8, but, you know, when I was with the 101st, we were setting up and we heard some clanking, and so what happened was we had set up so close to their perimeter that they had to move their mortars back. Uh-oh. Not good.
Yeah.
You know. You know, it's, as I said, that's why we try to get in just as it's getting dark. So by the time we are settled in and our stuff is set up, it's dark.
Mm-hmm.
Then Charlie settles in right after dark. And then before it gets too light, he takes off and gets on the road because he knows the road. You gotta wait till the light gets gone and you get adjusted, right?
Mm-hmm.
So then you take off. Because you don't know the road and you're gonna be pecking around.
Mm-hmm.
And it fries your nerves. It does. And then when, and now this whole entire time there's no talking, there's whispering.
Of course.
Everything is just so unearthly quiet. And then at the first ring of the shot, it just becomes total pandemonium.
So you go from absolute science to just crazy. So,
yeah, it's not like somebody say, headquarters, we're in contact. The guy screams, all right, you motherfuckers, we're in contact. You know, and commo, forget commo discipline when it comes to alert team. Okay, we know exactly what to say. Shut the fuck up. Listen, and this is what I need, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, we are in contact.
Mm-hmm.
Because you got one guy that if he's talking, he ain't shooting. You know what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And but if you're set up initiating, preparing to initiate, they know where you are doing that. And it's different because they know where you're at. But if you're moving and something happens, which is what you call a chance meeting, your immediate action drills take place. If they're coming, actually, if you get ambushed, you should turn and run into the ambush. And that's the best way to fight your way out of an ambush.
Is to turn it and do it. And hit.
Right. And just go right forward because they got you in an L. Where the hell else are you going to go? So what you try to do is break through it. That's, you know, the textbook side of the story.
Mm-hmm. Now, how often would that happen to you?
Well, I was lucky. I never really got stuck in an ambush. An ambush is where they're plotting and waiting.
Mm-hmm.
But I've been attacked because I was sitting there and I shouldn't have been sitting there. And I thought I shouldn't have been sitting there either, but there wasn't nothing I could do. But,
mm-hmm.
And, you know, we were sitting where we shouldn't have been sitting. Now, if nothing, they knew that we knew that they were somewhere around there and we were going to bring help because we had the authorization as an E4 team leader on a alert team. You had the authorization to call on a B-52 strike. And that's high as you can go.
Mm-hmm.
And shit, halftime platoon leaders would take them an hour to do something like that, where ours would be, you know, they just say, hey, you better be about 1,000 meters in one terrain picture away, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, we would work more with the, you know, the artillery, trying to push them back, gunships cutting them off,
mm-hmm.
and then airstrikes, and then slicks trying to get us out. That's just get us the hell out.
How much could you call in? Could you guys call everything in, or were you limited as far as support, air support?
No, there was no, well, let's put it this way. You had an artillery section assigned to that mission for you,
mm-hmm.
and then you would have choppers, slicks, and guns assigned to react and to carry the reactionary force, and then you would have fast movers that were assigned to that AO, and then you had a FAC, which was a little bird dog,
mm-hmm.
that flew the AO and sort of kept an eye on you. Because, see, we would be out so far that we would have to put a 10 or 12 x-ray team, a radio relay team. They would have to put them out in the middle of the top of a hill so that we could have comma, because we were where no man had ever been before, and there was no friendlies or nothing.
Mm-hmm.
And with a little prick 20, nowadays, I mean, geez, I mean, man. I was sitting there in Philippines, and I break out this little antenna, look like a fan, and plug it in, and then get the mic, and I'd shoot an azimuth, get it close as I could, and I'd say one, I'd keep on saying one, 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 and it would bounce back one, 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 and then when you got your highest bounce back, you left it there, and then you called Okinawa.
Mm-hmm.
You know? I mean, and we had them damn put 25.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so, well, we had IRC 10s too. Mm-hmm. We had, which is, if all else fails, you turn this on, it can't be turned off, it can't be heard by anyone. It transmits within a 5-mile radius an emergency signal to any flying aircraft. And hopefully that happens. But what we do a lot of times is we'll do spot checks. Bird dog will be flying by and we'll use a mirror.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we'll use a mirror and we'll flash them and then we'll work the frequencies and get on them and then I'll guide them in. I'll say, you know, okay, we're at your 3 o'clock, 2,000 meters, you know, or 1,000 meters. And then he'll start flying, and I'll get him in, and when he gets, you know, flying over us prior to that, we will say a special word like bingo, and he flaps his wings, and he marks on his map, and that pilot's going to give you a 10-digit coordinates.
Mm-hmm.
He's going to give you, now you're watching your map, he's going to give you to within 10 meters of where you are, okay?
Mm-hmm.
And you feel pretty damn good. If you're within a couple hundred meters, you're doing damn good.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And so, and then sometimes they would hang out with you if you was having communication problems.
Mm-hmm.
But they were amazing. They were amazing in what they did, too. Because they did a lot of the aerial overflights also because the tune leader, his job was to support the teams. He didn't go out in the field. No, I shouldn't say that. Ours never did. They could if they wanted to on occasion. But they were supposed to run the support team behind them, keep everything flowing, go out there with the bird dog,
mm-hmm.
you know, check on you and stuff like that, and you know, sort of like a operations intelligence man, and usually. Well, the facts, like I said, the facts were, they were damn good.
Tell me about the facts. What, how would you describe their role and their effectiveness?
The what?
The facts. The forward air controllers.
Well, I don't know. I've heard different stories. I'd have to ask Chief about it, but,
well, what did you witness? I mean,
they were very hot. They were, a chopper is a hot rod.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, that sucker can zip and zap, and that's how, I mean, that's what saves so many lives and how we won every battle,
mm-hmm.
was the helicopter. We could be from point A to point B faster than any other war we'd ever been in. We could have them, if we had a man that was wounded really bad in that hospital, within an hour, he had 90% chance of surviving.
Mm-hmm.
Now, this guy here, he just was a slow hankerer, you know? It was like Cessna 182 or whatever they were. Some of them had these little rockets on them. First, they used to put a box of hand grenades in there so the guy in the back could throw them if he had to.
Mm-hmm.
And he just cruised around. And he was the forward air controller,
mm-hmm.
so he could control artillery or aircraft or both. And so, you know, he did, that was his job, to coordinate that everybody was on the right sheet of music,
mm-hmm.
and going in the right location. And sometimes, you know, they'd come down and they'd be shooting and throwing grenades, you know. They've done some, but, you know, and then you had the Cross the Magic Dragon. You had that C-130 that would ride around, and mm-hmm. it had automatic 30 caliber machine gun in it that could fire like 6,000 rounds a minute, and when it went across the football field, it would put one round in every square inch. I mean, that's how intense it was.
Mm-hmm.
And they would bank, and you might not see them. All of a sudden, you'd see this red trail, and then later you hear, "Aah!" You know,
mm-hmm.
because she was, well, that was when you wasn't real close to them. And they were outstanding. And gunships are real good to work with because you can get them pretty tight. Mm-hmm. Now, artillery, they're going to say, danger close. And you say, I said fire for effect, you son of a bitch, you know, because uh-huh. 600 meters is danger close.
Uh-huh.
All right? But Charlie knows that if the rounds land behind him, then he's going to try to come closer.
Right.
Fast.
But right.
Then you can't get in between them. So, It would just depend on your assets. I've had naval guns, but we got chased out of there. But then I wasn't around to watch, which I would have loved to see if it was sitting way out in the ocean there. Because when we were trying to get out, they said, "Where are you going?" I said, "To that boat, one way or another." You know. That's the only way out, but, you know, they had 16-inch guns, and once we were exfilled, they just, you know, leveled the area,
mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. and that was looking for a well.
It sounds like...
Well, we were looking for a very big water-producing well along the coastline,
mm-hmm.
and without that... they couldn't survive.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's why they didn't let us get at it.
Mm-hmm.
You know? And so, fortunately, we get out of there and they chase us out of there. And we use gunships and all that kind of stuff. But, mm-hmm.
How many missions total do you think you went on?
I don't know. I haven't counted it one time.
It'd be like 10 or 50.
More than that. No, not 50. Because you go on, like you might go on a mission that is over in 2 days, or you might go on 3 missions that last 4 or 5 days each time, you know,
mm-hmm.
and then you're going somewhere. There's just always something. You know,
mm-hmm.
but as soon as I got the E Company, they only give you about a week indoctrination. And then I went out on a mission. I was back a couple of days. Went out on another mission. Was back a couple of days. And was on another mission. And they, by then, had said that, you know, they wanted to keep me. And they were happy with me. Was I happy there? And said, yeah. I said, all right, well, pack your bags, you're going to Recondo school, and it starts Monday, and this is like a Wednesday or Thursday.
That's a pretty fast turnaround.
Huh?
That's a pretty fast turnaround. I mean, you got there, they took you out to see how you were, and then you say yes, and then you're off to Recon school.
Yeah, well, that's the way they want you. Mm-hmm. I mean, see, but I had already been in country
mm-hmm.
a year. So I was different than a guy who just came in country for 3 or 4 months.
Sure.
So I was different. Situation.
Mm-hmm. Which did you like better? Did you enjoy working with E Company better than your first tour? You know, that.
But to see what was happening in E Company, personnel wise, we were getting Kid Carsons. The younger guys didn't like them, and some of them to this day are loved by guys.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, because hell, you know, you put them up front, you know, they walk point, and, but...
How effective?
Just poor management on behalf of the Army, that they should have known, okay, at the six-month point, right?
Mm-hmm.
After we've been training for 3 months, we've got guys that are 90-day lost already. So they should have been had replacements coming in the ninth month,
mm-hmm.
To meet up with the 12th-month rotation. A lot of guys stayed. A lot of guys were dead. A lot of guys went other places. But they still should have had that. And that's what... it can destroy your morale is you get with a team, whether it's a five-man or a six-man team, and after you run a several missions together, you just sticking together, you just love it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I mean, you just know it's right. And then they say, hey, we need you and you to go here. Not that you don't like the guys, you love the guys, but, you know, you haven't worked with them, it's ad hoc, you know,
mm-hmm.
and that was starting to happen. And, then all that shit happened with me. I was trying to go over to the same place where I was, but it was B Company 5th Group, and work at the yards and do long range patrol with the mountain yard. That's what they did up in the Central Highlands.
Mm-hmm.
So I was going to Laos and stuff like that.
That's what you did?
Yeah, that's what I was volunteered for on my third tour. Now, I had already been in, I can say this now, well, once. I don't know.
What, say?
Everybody knows that our company was in, you know, outside Vietnam before we were supposed to be.
Right, yeah, all that.
They were supposed to be out there, but they were doing it like maybe six or eight mountain yards and three or four Americans.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, and, you know, they lived and breathed and eat together, and
mm-hmm.
it was just, and they just, it just became a way of life.
Yeah.
I wanted to stay. I figured if I would have stayed, I probably would have stayed there. And from there, if I didn't stay there, I would have probably went maybe down to the Trang and headquarters or something like that. But as soon as I mentioned the Trang, they said, no way, B Company. I said, okay, I'll take B Company. B Company was great because people didn't understand it, but Project Omega was going on, which was this big thing around the Third Corps area, which was in the, like I said, the Central Highlands and inland. And Project Omega, which was a Special Forces project, they were getting called to do all this recon stuff.
Mm-hmm.
So the special team, B-36, that not many people know about it, they picked up the slack while the Army purposely developed a core-level recon company. That's what was the reason why it was done,
mm-hmm.
so was to free up the SF guys so that they could go about their business, and then we took care of, you know, this side of the border mostly.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, I met a guy who was on I mentioned B-36, and he said, what'd you say? And I said, B-36. He said, you know about B-36? And I said, yeah. And he said, oh, okay. He said, why? I said, why? He said, I was there. I said, yeah. And he said, no. And see, a lot of people did not understand. But once again, being in the Army, being around, and then being with Special Forces, and then wanting to go to Special Forces, and, you know, working with them, you know, we basically knew what the operations were all about and why we were there.
Mm-hmm.
We freed them up to go, you know, farther and further and do what they're supposed to be doing. You know.
Yes.
And that, so. And then everybody woke up on 1 February 1969, mm-hmm. all 13 LERP units, mm-hmm. which were now a lettered LERP, E Company 20th Infantry, F Company 58th Infantry, even though they were assigned, like, to the 101st Airborne, they were, you know, F Company 58 Long Range Patrol, you know, mm-hmm. it was just some designator. Well, they brought back the old regimental system, and they changed every one in country, and there was two LERP companies, one was stateside, one was in Europe, and one was A, one was B, and then they made them letter Ranger companies, and they took the lineage from Merle's Marauders, which were the 75th Rangers. Mm-hmm. Actually, they started out as the 4705 Provincial, and they're the ones that fought in Papua New Guinea and China, and mm-hmm. that group. Mm-hmm. They were away from the battalion, so to speak. Mm-hmm. And then they became the 75th Infantry in Okinawa, then they deactivated them. So then they reactivated them on 1 February 69, and being the biggest and the baddest, mm-hmm. became C Company.
Okay.
And we had C through P, but we never use J when we have a name of company. We don't use that letter because it can be misinterpreted by other letters. So there's no, it's like A, B, C, D, E, F, E, yeah, mm-hmm. A, B, C, D, E, F, G, H, I, K L M N O P Q R. There's no Juliet Company.
Right.
You know, so, mm-hmm. And we became Charlie Rangers. And if, when I went back into service, I mean, you know, Charlie Rangers, just the sound, the name, but the people who came to our unit.
Mm-hmm.
We had guys like Dave Dolby, who had been there 5 years and had already won the Medal of Honor. He could have went anywhere. Where'd he go? He came to our company. You know, mm-hmm. other guys who had had the DSC, who had been over there 4 or 5 years, where'd they go? Charlie, 75th Ranger.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, because, you know, we were taking care of business. And then when they hooked us with the 173rd, which was November company, they were ass kickers. We fit in perfect. You know, it was a good way to end. Because it was a good way to end because we started by out of the 101st, evolved through the help of them to become Charlie 75th, and then was assigned to with the 173rd LERPs when we finished. And they were the only two airborne units in Vietnam. Except for the 82nd, they sent the 3rd Brigade for a year and realized that they screwed up.
Mm-hmm. Well, Terry, why don't we stop for today, and we'll pick up here.
I was just about to say that.
Okay, good. We'll pick up here in our next session, okay? Thank you.